Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
A cautionary tale. Start this morning with a cliche phrase. I suspect many people in the media were saying to themselves yesterday, there, but for the grace of God, go I. The particular career-killing act we're about to describe isn't something that just anyone would do. But the idea, especially acute in 2020, that you can have an absolutely great career and have that career almost immediately and entirely derailed by a single really stupid act is really chilling. Consider the case of Jeffrey Toobin, a deeply respected writer and television commentator who until yesterday served regularly as the on-air chief justice correspondent for CNN.
What really amazes me is the John Thunes, the Susan Collins who say, the president has learned his lesson.
Yeah.
No, he has not. No, he has not. He is going to do this again. He said he will do it again. And the idea that there is some chastening here is absurd.
Toobin has been a fixture on CNN for decades, and this story shows how he remained firmly placed among the media elite. Imagine this, a top-tier Zoom call. People on the call, some of the biggest writers from the most respected magazine in the country. Toobin is on a call with colleagues from The New Yorker, who are playing some...
Rich DeMuro was on there?
No, these are just... This is our generic
Zoom. Our Zoom video.
Oh, okay. His kids
planning
were on?
Some special...
Yikes.
Election coverage, along with not only folks from The New Yorker, from New York City's premier public radio station, WNYC, all told, about 20 people are on the Zoom call. There's some breakout rooms. Speaking of breaking out, according to press reports, at some point, Toobin engages in an intimate act of self-gratification, seemingly unaware that a Zoom camera is on. For his part, Toobin calls the incident an embarrassing and stupid mistake. New Yorker has suspended the longtime writer. Toobin himself asked to be taken off the air at CNN while he deals with a, quote, personal issue. I'll say, what happens to Toobin now? His best-selling book about the O.J. Simpson trial, The Run of His Life, was the basis for the star-studded FX movie. Toobin had other books in development for Hollywood productions. And as you can imagine, this has received huge headlines all around the world. And the question many people are asking, especially in this climate, can Toobin's career survive? It is one of the fastest and furthest falls one can possibly imagine. So will this staple of the media, both in print and broadcast, vanish forever? Or is there some path back? It's impossible to rank these things. There's another CNN colleague who had a deeply embarrassing and public scandal who reestablished his career and is on the air today. For their part, The New Yorker says they're conducting a complete investigation. But the whole thing, scary and sad for the many, myself among them, who really admired Jeffrey Toobin.
Context of white supremacy. Scary, they said. My goodness. Woo! I am so excited. This is the Cal's Book Club, Gusty Renegade, in for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. Today's date, Thursday, November 26, 2020, so I have been told, unhand that turkey leg, put that stuffing down, no more bites from that country ham biscuit. It is time for the book club. I am so excited. I'm absolutely overjoyed that we are done with Isabel Wilkerson's case, never to be spoken of again, second worst book ever, and... We get double duty treats O.J. Simpson. I have never had any interest in the O.J. Simpson trial. I've never read any books on the O.J. Simpson trial. I've never watched any documentaries on the O.J. Simpson trial, any of the movie series, the ESPN documentary that's like 50 hours. I didn't watch any of that. Like, I have generally avoided all of the content to the degree that I can. And mostly because I didn't really have an opinion about this case. I was a child and all this stuff happened and wasn't vested in the events at all, except to note my fury that this disrupted the 1994 NBA Finals to show the Bronco chase with O.J. Simpson. I mean, for years, that was the pinnacle, really, the entirety of my emotion about this case was not he did it. and I'm outraged that he's free. Not that I think, you know, this is an attempt to railroad a black guy, and I'm happy that he's out. None of that. Like, I don't know. I don't care. They interrupted the finals. Like, are you serious? Like, I don't care who he stabbed. Like, Patrick Ewing is like, that was all I cared about this case for years. I did not watch the court case, any of that. So it is... Man, it is something for me to be coming to this now for the first time after all the these years to say, oh, well, let's read something related to the biggest trial. They say the trial of the century. At least from my perspective, this is easily the largest trial. It's beyond the 20th century. I think there's nothing I can think of in the first 20 years of this century, and maybe this is the biggest trial, at least in the United States, like, ever. Like, I'm not aware of any court case that is referenced more often than this case for all kinds of reasons. Not Brown v. Board of Education, not Plessy v. Ferguson, Roe v. Wade. Like, there's not one court case I can think of that gets referenced more. I'm not a legal scholar. So, you know, maybe that's for other folks to debate about the importance of this case. But, wow, it has got to be tops on the list for important trials, important events. Whew. We are reading Jeffrey Toobin, The Run of His Life, The People v. O.J. Simpson. As the report at the beginning alludes to, and we'll probably have reports like that to start off these book sessions for a while, we're not reading this book now because I just crawled out from under a rock and found out, oh, there's a hit, you know, miniseries that was based on this book. That's not why we're reading this book right now. We're not reading this book because I saw O.J. Simpson someplace cool or any other reason. We're reading this book because the famous Jeffrey Toobin, legal analyst at CNN. He hasn't even been fired from CNN. Just fired days ago from The New Yorker after a 25-year career there. Jeffrey Toobin, his book that the FX miniseries that was a huge, like, meteoric success, got all the Emmy Award nominations and everything else, that miniseries was based on Mr. Toobin's book, and Mr. Toobin was a consultant to that project, and Mr. Toobin is actually dramatized in the film when he has a meeting with Robert Shapiro, OJ's defense attorney. So I am overjoyed to be reading this book. It'll take us through the end of the year. Some might say, Gus T. Renegade, you have got to be a world-class coon to do a radio program that addresses racism, and this is the first time in nearly 12 years of broadcasting that we are devoting time to Orenthal James Simpson. Stunning. Cowbells, Johnny Cochran, and I had to make sure so many things. We started this year in the book club reading about Johnny Cochran. For those who were with us what seems like 50 years ago, we were reading Harriet A. Washington, A Terrible Thing to Waste, and she talked about Johnny A. Cochran. She got in a quick jab about that no-count O.J. Simpson, but she brought Johnny Cochran up relevant to that book because of his efforts fighting against environmental racism in Alabama. That's why he was referenced at the beginning of this year. Now we go full circle all the way back to Johnny Cochran at year's end for the case he is most known for. Woof, I'm overjoyed, and especially because I've been watching the beginning part of the FX series now because I'm trying to match up and see how it relates to the book and all that. I can say to start off immediately, a just enormous difference between the two. The FX series starts off with the Rodney King beating and the aftermath, the riots and all that. That's how the FX series starts, very much like the Spike Lee film for Minister Malcolm X. Jeffrey Toobin's book, The Run of His Life, The People v. O.J. Simpson, starts with a love letter from O.J. Simpson. So I'm just going to read you the love letter so we all start from the same point. It reads, Nicole, well, it seems that the worst part is behind us. I want you to know that whatever you might think to the contrary, I've taken full responsibility spelled wrong, for this. It happened and I'm doing everything possible to assure it don't happen again. Don't and again misspelled. But sooner or later, we must start misspelled, with our future. I love our time last weekend. I know to you it may not have been much, but it showed we can get along. I love you, and losing you is the only thing that matter, M-A-D-D-E-R, to me. So let's not forget the past. Let's work together for the first time to improve the future, future misspelled, live together. No manner, M-A-N-N-E-R, what, I love you, OJ. And it's captioned, letter from O.J. Simpson to Nicole Brown Simpson following his plea of no contest to domestic violence charges in 1989. That is substantially different. So Jeffrey Toobin's book starts with a love letter purportedly from O.J. to Nicole Brown Simpson that is poorly spelled, illiterate black male killer. The FX series starts with the beating of Rodney King. You're going to go into these projects with a hugely different frame of mind as to what to expect or what you think this is all about or what the tone of this is going to be. Very, very different beginnings to these projects. With that, I guess the last thing I'll say, I'm so excited about this. I wrote a haiku in preparation for our subject matter today. My haiku, I'll read it quickly. 5-7-5 format, right? My haiku is titled, appropriately, haiku for Christopher Darden. He's on the prosecution. Called me Uncle Tom 'cause I prosecuted juice, innocent fevers. Haiku for Christopher Darden. We'll hear more about him as we proceed. I'm so excited. Jeffrey Toobin. The people, well, let me give it the correct title, Jeffrey Toobin, The Run of His Life, The People versus O.J. Simpson. Cannot wait. Context of White Supremacy, audio segment one.
Audible Studios presents The Run of His Life, The People versus O.J. Simpson, written by Jeffrey Toobin, performed by Stephen Bell Davies.
Prologue. What the lawyers knew. One after another, the Jaguars, the BMWs, and the odd Porsche pulled off the Avenue of the Stars and slipped into the nearly deserted underground parking garage. The owners of these cars, about 24 of the top lawyers in West Los Angeles, greeted each other with slightly embarrassed smiles. All white, virtually all men, and mostly in their early 50s, they reflected the culture in which they had thrived, one where workaholism was no virtue, and a weekend in the office anathema. Yet here they were, on a glorious summer Saturday afternoon, June 25th, 1994, forsaking golf and family for a meeting in the Century City Tower. They came because everyone wanted a piece of this case, the defense of Orenthal James Simpson, against charges that he had murdered his ex-wife Nicole and her friend Ronald Goldman. Besides, they came because Robert Shapiro, Simpson's lead lawyer, had asked them. Many of these lawyers, who were among those closest to Shapiro, never knew precisely what to make of their friend. They could quickly catalog his faults, his outsized ego, his self-obsession, his excessive comfort with the moral ambiguities of his profession. Bob would have cocktails with Hitler, the wife of one of the lawyers at the meeting used to say. They chuckled at his endless socializing. Shapiro owned 3 tuxedos. He had once declined a lunch date with one of the lawyers, Alvin Michelson, by explaining, without a touch of humor, "I only have lunch with people who can help me. It's part of my workday. I eat with clients, judges, and prosecutors. But so, too, these lawyers knew another side of Shapiro, that of the generous friend. When the wife of Roger Cossack, another lawyer at the meeting, had died a few years earlier after a terrible bout of cancer, Bob Shapiro had been the first person to arrive at Cossack's house to offer comfort after the funeral. When the Internal Revenue Service had begun investigating scores of professional athletes for evading taxes on the income they made from appearing at autograph shows, many had come running to Shapiro for assistance. He, in turn, had referred much of that business to his friends, and consequently had paid for the additions to more than a few lawyers' houses. They remembered that, so they answered his call. Shapiro greeted his colleagues on this Saturday with his trademark bear hugs and ushered them into a conference room. If you looked carefully out the window, you could make out Bundy Drive in Brentwood, just 3 miles west. 13 days before this meeting, Nicole Brown Simpson and Ronald Goldman had been murdered near the front steps of her home on Bundy. A pair of late-night dog walkers had discovered the grisly scene. Nicole, at the foot of the front steps, her throat slashed down to the vertebrae. Ron, in a heap nearby, his torso and neck both savaged by fatal wounds. The following week, Shapiro had been retained to represent the prime suspect in the case, O.J. Simpson, who was Nicole's ex-husband, as well as a very famous man. On June 17th, the day Shapiro had agreed that Simpson would surrender to police, the former football star vanished. With virtually the entire nation watching on television, Simpson's friend, Robert Kardashian, read what sounded like a suicide note that Simpson had left behind. In the end, Simpson did not take his own life. He eventually turned himself in later that day, following a surreal televised chase on the freeways of Southern California. Technically, the space where the attorneys gathered was not really Shapiro's at all. Because he didn't have a conference room of his own, Shapiro had borrowed one from the large law firm where he rented space. Under the pressures of the Simpson case, Shapiro would come to use it so often that he eventually broke down and added the conference room to his sublet arrangement. Like most criminal defense attorneys, even the best known, Shapiro ran a lean business operation. He had a secretary and two young lawyers as associates. Every month, Shapiro wrote out by hand all the checks to cover his office expenses, including payroll. In recent years, he had no trouble meeting that payroll. Business was good. But Shapiro was ever mindful of the criminal defense attorney's dilemma. Successful though one may be, one can never count on repeat business. An unending supply of new clients must always be found. The quest for clients, his own and his friends, was an important subtext for the gathering he had assembled this summer afternoon. Summoning the participants by telephone earlier in the week, Shapiro had said he wanted to discuss the Simpson case. The preliminary hearing would begin the following Thursday, June 30th. Shapiro said he wanted to pick the brains of the best in the business beforehand. "Please help me," he said. "I need your advice." The lawyers came running, as Shapiro knew they would, for he understood that the invitation itself was a gift. The Simpson case was already a national sensation. In the gossipy, competitive Los Angeles legal world, Shapiro discerned that his conclave would be, in fact already was, the talk of the city. Any lawyer would treasure the opportunity to mention the fact that Bob Shapiro had called to talk about the O.J. case. Friends, fellow lawyers, and especially clients, and even more especially prospective clients, would be impressed. The high end of criminal defense law operates almost entirely on a referral basis. That is, lawyers are hired because other lawyers recommend them. And Shapiro knew that his guests on this Saturday would not soon forget he had included them in this extraordinary session. A profitable referral to Shapiro would be the appropriate gesture of gratitude. After the lawyers had settled in around the large oval table, Shapiro began the proceedings with a question. "So," he said, "how many of you think O.J. did it?" Everyone froze. After a moment, a few lawyers chuckled nervously and others rolled their eyes. In a flash, Shapiro had brought home just how strange this meeting was. Defense lawyers talk to each other about their cases all the time, often with brutal candor. Does my guy take a plea or not? Is my case triable? Winnable? In these discussions, guilt is a given. Experienced criminal lawyers, the successful ones, harbor few illusions. These chats are private. The cases are usually unknown to the public. But Shapiro was talking about what was well on its way to becoming the most sensational legal proceeding in American history. This was not the kind of question, or so it seemed, that an experienced criminal defense attorney would want answered in a quasi-public setting. But Shapiro's question made a point. Though he was now, as Simpson's attorney, more famous than any of his friends around the conference table, he was still one of the boys. He still knew the score. He had no more illusions about this client than any other. The spotlight would never blind him to reality. After his initial query brought only awkward silence, Shapiro moved quickly to introduce two of the guests, Skip Taft and Robert Kardashian, who were, for Shapiro's purposes, the most important audience for the meeting. Taft and Kardashian were lawyers, too, but that wasn't the point. Taft was O.J. Simpson's business manager, the man who would decide, among other things, how much Shapiro would be paid. Kardashian had known Simpson for 30 years, and in the days since the murders, he had emerged as the defendant's closest friend and advisor. The gossip had already made the rounds that these two men had been instrumental in replacing Simpson's original lawyer, Howard Weitzman, with Shapiro. Attention had to be paid. It was for them that Shapiro had assembled this show of legal strength. Almost everyone else knew one another. This was, as they sometimes joked, the West L.A. Jewish Mafia. Taft and Kardashian were among the very few non-Jews in the room. In fact, as the group settled in, Alvin Michelson whispered to his neighbor, "This is what it must have been like at Appalachian, the infamous gathering of mob chieftains in upstate New York in 1957. It was a famously inbred group, and their connections to one another often stretched back decades. Among Shapiro's oldest friends in the room was Roger Cossack, who had pledged with Shapiro to the Zeta Beta Tau fraternity at UCLA in the early 1960s. The Simpson case would transform Cossack's life as much as it did Shapiro's. Cossack became CNN's legal expert on the trial, and when it was over, he quit the law altogether and moved to Washington to begin his own daily legal affairs broadcast on the cable network. When prosecutors began examining Kardashian's behavior in the aftermath of the murders, he hired Michelson as his attorney. When Shapiro was later sued for libel in connection with the Simpson case, he asked another attendee, Larry Feldman, to represent him. Feldman was ribbed mercilessly that Saturday because, due to go to a wedding, he came to Shapiro's office in black tie. For his part, Shapiro presided in an all-white designer sweatsuit. One of the few civil litigation specialists at the meeting was Patricia Glazer, a partner at the large law firm then known as Christensen White Miller Fink and Jacobs. A year and a half later, when the Simpson trial was over, her name would be added to the firm's name along with that of the newest partner, Robert Shapiro. Another of Shapiro's ZBT brothers, Mike Nassiter, was there too, along with his longtime partner, Richard Hirsch. About 15 years earlier, they had employed a Southwestern law student by the name of Marcia Klecks as an intern. She later married Gordon Clark and took his name. Johnny Cochran, who was not part of Shapiro's social set, was not invited. "I've asked you all here today because you all know how to try a case," Shapiro said, "and I'm not afraid to ask for your help. But Shapiro actually asked few questions, and though he was pleased to have collected all these fine lawyers together, he didn't listen much to what they had to say. Shapiro's confidence was astonishing. He had the answer for O.J. Simpson. His client, he vowed, would go to trial and be acquitted. The strategy was set. Shapiro was caught up short only once. Michael Bodden, the eminent medical examiner whom Shapiro had retained as an expert in the case, mentioned at the meeting that the autopsy results on the victims showed the possibility that more than one person had killed Nicole and Ron. Robert Shapiro paused to consider the implications. "So," he asked the group, "that means O.J. and who else did it?" This remark, too, drew stunned silence, and the meeting soon broke up. Shapiro took several of the participants out to dinner at Nikki Blair's, a venerable and now defunct Hollywood hangout. A few hearty souls concluded the evening with drinks at the Beverly Hills estate of Shapiro's friend and former client, Robert Evans, the movie producer whom Shapiro had steered clear of formal charges in the infamous Cotton Club murders of 1983. Among the guests at Shapiro's meeting most pleased to have been invited was Marshall Grossman. Though he had enjoyed considerable success in the world of civil litigation, Grossman had never tried a criminal case, and the glamour and excitement of the Simpson case appealed to him. However, as Grossman later pondered what he had heard at the meeting, he hesitated. Grossman had tried cases for high stakes before, but he realized that this case, as Shapiro planned to defend it, would become something much bigger than the trial of a single defendant. If Shapiro had his way, it would come to involve, and possibly consume, the whole city of Los Angeles. Ultimately, Grossman decided this kind of public spectacle would not be for him. The notion that Grossman might play a part in the Simpson case had generated excitement at his law firm, and he felt he owed his colleagues an explanation for his decision. At 11:12 a.m. on July 6, 1994, he sent an email message around his firm that said, "I am sending a letter to the lead trial lawyer in the case this morning, informing him of my decision not to join the defense effort. The Simpson case," Grossman went on, "carries with it a high risk of racial divisiveness for our community, a situation which I don't wish to contribute to, and would rather reserve the opportunity for a healing role, if need be." Johnny L., just L., Cochran Jr., loved appearing on Nightline, as well as the Today Show, the CBS Evening News, and the NBC Nightly News. In the days immediately after the murders in Brentwood, he did them all, and the program's producers were happy to have him, too. Cochran was a poised, accomplished, telegenic African-American lawyer, the answer to a network booker's dreams. Within a week of the murders, the Today Show even made him a paid consultant. As it happened on the evening of June 17, 1994, the day Al Cowlings led the nation on the low-speed chase down the Los Angeles freeways, Cochran was booked to analyze the events of the day on Nightline. Though television viewers never knew it, Cochran's position in the case was considerably more complicated than that of the other legal experts who were surfacing in the media to analyze the case. Cochran had personal knowledge of what was going on behind the scenes. He was a friend of O.J. Simpson's, not, in normal circumstances, an intimate confidant, but certainly a long-term acquaintance. Since the day of the murders, Simpson had been on the phone with Cochran talking about his plight and asking the attorney to join in his defense efforts. On the air, Cochran was cautious and only mildly pro-defense. His comment that evening on Nightline was typical of what he was saying on all the programs. "I think the important thing for all Americans to understand is that this is a tragic, tragic case. But at this point, he's still presumed to be innocent." Off camera, though, Cochran, like Shapiro, could afford to be more blunt. For example, during a break in the broadcast of Nightline on June 17th in ABC Studios in Los Angeles, Cochran sized up the situation very differently from the way he did for the program's viewers. O.J. is in massive denial, Cochran told a friend. He obviously did it. He should do a diminished capacity plea, and he might have a chance to get out in a reasonable amount of time. When, the following week, Cochran traveled to Burbank for his early morning duty to the Today Show, he expressed the same sentiments, likewise to friends off-camera. But in the days to come, as Cochran continued to listen to Simpson's entreaties, the lawyer learned that the defendant had no interest in pleading guilty. He wanted to go to trial and win, and he wanted Cochran to represent him. Cochran was torn. He enjoyed the broadcasting work. It was easy, flattering, low stress, and at several $100s per appearance on Today, the money wasn't bad either. But how could he turn down what was shaping up to be the trial of the century? Unlike Shapiro, Cochran's métier was trying cases, working before juries in a courtroom. Questioning Cochran on the June 20th edition of the Today Show, Bryant Gumbel made note of the differences in the two men's reputations. "Mr. Shapiro has a great reputation as a plea bargainer," Gumbel said. "Do you think him the best man to represent O.J. in a criminal trial?" Cochran's response was a study in condescension toward Shapiro, and nothing less than an advertisement for himself. "Well, again," Cochran told Gumbel, "I think there are lawyers and there are lawyers. He is a fine lawyer, but if the matter is to be tried, I think one needs one who is very well experienced and skilled in trying cases, a litigator, if you will. And I would not be surprised if you didn't see a lawyer, another lawyer, trial lawyer, come in and do that." Cochran, of course, did not let on that he was in fact at that very moment weighing whether to step in and take that trial lawyer role. After the preliminary hearing ended on July 8th and Simpson was ordered to stand trial in 60 days, Cochran knew he had to make up his mind. He had a large circle of friends and often liked to talk himself into, or out of, ideas by bouncing them off others. Cochran worked the phones. One afternoon in mid-July, the phone rang in the office of a lawyer who also knew the stresses of high-profile cases. "You should do it," Cochran teased the lawyer. But he was really turning his own possible role over in his mind. The upside wasn't difficult to recognize. Any trial lawyer would relish the chance to perform in front of the biggest audience in American legal history. The downside, as Cochran explained it, was more complex. Simpson was a peer. "He's a friend," Cochran said, "and that's a mess when you start trying to represent a friend." Cochran wondered whether their relationship might hinder his ability to conduct the case the way he wanted. The last problem was, in many ways, the simplest, but also the most profound. Cochran's relationship with his friend was such that he could speak in a shorthand they would both understand. He hesitated for a while before he came out and said what was on his mind. If Johnny Cochran's career had established anything at that point, it was that he liked to win. But he had talked to his prospective client and sized up the evidence against him. Ultimately, Cochran's problem with the Simpson case was a simple one. "The case," said Cochran, "is a loser." Of course they knew. Of course Robert Shapiro and Johnny Cochran knew from the start what any reasonably attentive student of the murders of Nicole Brown Simpson and Ronald Lyle Goldman could see, that O.J. Simpson was guilty of killing them. Their dilemma, then, was the oldest, as well as the most common quandary of the criminal defense attorney. What to do about a guilty client? The answer, they decided, was race. Because of the overwhelming evidence of Simpson's guilt, his lawyers could not undertake a defense aimed at proving his innocence, one that sought to establish, say, that some other person had committed the murders. Instead, in an astonishing act of legal bravado, they sought to create for the client, a man they believed to be a killer, the mantle of victimhood. Almost from the day of Simpson's arrest, his lawyers sought to invent a separate narrative, an alternative reality for the events of June 12, 1994. This fictional version was both elegant and dramatic. It posited that Simpson was the victim of a wide-ranging conspiracy of racist law enforcement officials who had fabricated and planted evidence in order to frame him for a crime he did not commit. It was also, of course, an obscene parody for an authentic civil rights struggle. For this one pitted a guilty victim against innocent perpetrators. These conclusions are the result of more than 2 years of reporting on the Simpson case. The week after the murders, I was assigned to cover the story for the New Yorker magazine. In addition to attending Simpson's trial in Los Angeles Superior Court, I interviewed more than 200 people, many of them repeatedly. I have had access to the full documentary record of the case, including internal memoranda of both the prosecution and the defense teams. Advice provided by jury consultants to both the prosecution and the defense, the police murder book with its summaries of all LAPD interviews with witnesses, the written summaries of all witness interviews by members of the defense team, heretofore secret grand jury testimony, and depositions from the pending civil case against Simpson. I have also reviewed the enormous coverage of the case in the news media, an especially important task in the context of this case. The participants in the Simpson case worked obsessively to influence press coverage. These efforts to shape the news, some successful, some not, had important and lasting consequences from the night of the murders to the morning of the verdict. Indeed, the heart of the defense strategy featured an effort at public storytelling, the creation of a counter-narrative based on the idea of a police conspiracy to frame Simpson. For this effort, the defense needed a receptive audience, which it most definitely had in the African Americans who dominated the jury pool in downtown Los Angeles. The defense strategy played to experiences that were anything but fictional. Above all, the decades of racism in and by the Los Angeles Police Department. The defense sought to identify the Simpson case as the latest in a series of racial abuses by the LAPD, which featured such celebrated outrages as the Rodney King case and thousands of other insults and affronts, great and small. This legacy of black distrust of the LAPD was the fertile soil in which the Simpson defense strategy grew. As the events of the case unfolded, the LAPD more than lived up to its reputation as one of the worst big city police departments in the United States. One that tolerated sloth, incompetence, and racism. As it happened, though, bad as the LAPD was, it did not frame O.J. Simpson. No one planted or fabricated any evidence. In fact, the defense cleverly obscured the one actual police conspiracy that was revealed over the course of the case, that of the star-struck cops who in 1989 tried to minimize and excuse O.J. Simpson's history of domestic violence. It is ultimately unknowable whether a brilliant effort by prosecutors in the Simpson case could have produced a conviction in spite of the defense effort to make the case a racial referendum. There was, alas, no such splendid performance. Indeed, despite the best intentions, the case was largely botched by the Los Angeles District Attorney's Office. The prosecutors were undone by the twin afflictions most common among government lawyers: arrogance, mostly Marcia Clark's, and ineptitude, largely Christopher Darden's. Drunk on virtue, the prosecutors squandered what little chance they had for victory. At its core, the Simpson case was a horrific yet routine domestic violence homicide. It metastasized into a national drama, one that exposed deep fissures in American society. For one reason, because the defendant's lawyers thought that using race would help their client win an acquittal. It did. That was all that mattered to them. More than a decade ago, Alan Dershowitz, one of Simpson's lawyers, gave a candid précis of the approach that would characterize the defense team's efforts. In his book, The Best Defense, Dershowitz wrote, "Once I decide to take a case, I have only one agenda. I want to win. I will try by every fair and legal means to get my client off, without regard to the consequences. Chapter 1. Drop Dead Gorgeous. The geographic spine of Brentwood, indeed the spine of wealthy West Los Angeles, is Sunset Boulevard. The legendary thoroughfare begins modestly, just a few blocks from the Los Angeles Criminal Courts building, in the city's forlorn downtown, where it begins its 20-mile trek west to the Pacific Ocean. From downtown it passes through the honky-tonk precincts of Hollywood, and then moves ever upscale, through Beverly Hills, and then to Bel Air. When Sunset then crosses the San Diego Freeway, the air clears, literally. The next community is Brentwood, where ocean breezes scrub the pervasive smog from the sky. Here, in its last stop before the ocean, Sunset Boulevard shimmies along the base of the foothills that lead up to the Santa Monica Mountains. When planners first laid out Brentwood in the 1920s, their model was Golden Gate Park in San Francisco. The little roads that sprout from Sunset still follow the curves of the hills. Big houses have always been the rule in Brentwood, in the usual stylistic mix for wealthy Los Angeles. Normandy farmhouse, English Tudor, English Cotswold cottage, Spanish colonial revival. In one respect, the houses in Brentwood differ from their wealthy cousins in the Hollywood Hills or Beverly Hills. It is a less showy neighborhood, with fewer modernist architectural gestures and Rococo European follies. A conservative place. The iron law of real estate in Brentwood is simple and unchanging. North of Sunset, sometimes called Brentwood Park, is better than south. On February 23, 1977, O.J. Simpson bought a house on a prime corner lot at 360 North Rockingham for $650,000. Real estate agents say the house is probably worth about $4 million in 1996. The home reflects the stolid grandeur of the hilly neighborhood north of Sunset Boulevard. 6,000 square feet in a timber and stone frame, with an adjoining pool and tennis court. A 6-foot-tall brick wall protects the house's privacy. Some of Simpson's monthly expenses, as revealed in legal papers from his 1992 divorce from Nicole, give a sense of the scale of the place. $13,488 annually for utilities, $10,129 for gardening, and $4,371 for pool, tennis court services. Shortly after O.J. bought the house, he began seeing 18-year-old Nicole Brown. And then he separated from his wife, Marguerite. At the time, O.J. was 30 and near the end of his professional football career. O.J. and Marguerite divorced in 1979. The same year that their 2-year-old daughter, Erin, accidentally drowned in the pool at Rockingham. Nicole lived with O.J. in the Rockingham house for more than a decade, through their marriage in 1985, the birth of their daughter, Sydney, 8 months later, and the birth of their son, Justin, in 1988. However, when they separated in February 1992, there was never any doubt that the house was his. As Simpson stated in a declaration filed as part of the divorce proceeding with Nicole, "Because of the nature of my estate and my existing obligations, I requested that Nicole sign a prenuptial agreement. There were substantial negotiations over a period of 7 to 9 months, which resulted in a signed agreement essentially providing that all property rights would remain separate." So Nicole and the 2 children moved to nearby 325 Gretna Greenway, in a quiet and pleasant part of Brentwood, without gated estates on the southern side of Sunset. Her new house reflected one of the most common styles for modern California homes, which might be called Discount Mission. Spray-on stucco lined the exterior walls, a few wooden beams spruced up the sides, and clay tiles covered the roof. A 2-car garage dominated the front. As their divorce litigation went forward in 1992, it became clear that Nicole had many years earlier made herself a hostage to O.J.'s fortunes. In the divorce proceeding, Nicole pressed O.J. for both child and spousal support, stressing her complete financial dependence on him. "I am not currently employed and spend my time caring for my two young children," she declared in an affidavit. Her attorneys wrote in a brief that as a teenager, around the time she met Simpson, Nicole worked as a waitress for 2 months. Prior to that, she worked as a sales clerk in a boutique. She worked there for a total of 2 weeks and did not make a single sale. These two jobs are the sum total of her employment experience. In a court-ordered meeting with a vocational counselor, Nicole described herself as a party animal and said her personal goals were to raise my kids as best as I can. Beyond that, I haven't thought about me. She added, "I'm sure I will get a goal someday." It wasn't until Nicole was in her mid-30s and divorced that she began to consider entering the business world. Her friend and fellow party animal, Faye Resnick, later reported in a book about Nicole that at the time of her death, the two women were hoping to open a coffee house in Brentwood called Java Cafe, or something like that, with poetry readings and fabulous teas and coffees. O.J. and Nicole's divorce was settled without a trial. On October 15, 1992, the parties agreed that O.J., whose after-tax income amounted to $55,000 monthly, that is, $660,000 a year, would pay Nicole $10,000 a month in child support. Nicole kept title to a rent-producing condominium in San Francisco, and O.J. agreed to make a one-time payment to her of $433,750. "It is the intent of the parties," the settlement stated, "that a substantial portion of this sum shall be used by Nicole for the acquisition of a residence." Real estate agents in Brentwood speak about the extraordinary intimacy of their relationships with their clients. The brokers are often women who have entered the business as a new career in midlife. According to an experienced agent, people are so wrapped up in their houses here that you become their confessors. "It's amazing what I hear. People think nothing of telling their brokers that they were raped by their fathers." Nicole Simpson quickly developed a close relationship with Jean McKenna, who had been a broker in Brentwood since 1978. They had much in common. Both had been married to prominent athletes in Los Angeles. McKenna's ex-husband is Jim Lefevre, the former Dodger infielder whom she had met when she was a flight attendant. When the two women met in October 1993, McKenna learned that Nicole had been divorced for about a year. After a period of on-and-off reconciliations with O.J., she was finally ready to buy her own place. Nicole needed to move quickly on a purchase. She had sold the rental property in San Francisco, and to avoid taxes on the sale, she was required to invest the proceeds promptly in another rent-producing property. According to Jean McKenna, she was paying $5,000 a month at Gretna Green, which had a pool and a guest house, so when she bought a new place, she wasn't going to get everything she had before, but this would be her own. As it turned out, McKenna had just what Nicole wanted. In exasperation, Jean McKenna used to refer to 875 South Bundy Drive as her career listing, the house she couldn't sell. Bundy Drive is the main north-south artery of Brentwood, a noisy, busy, traffic-filled thoroughfare. McKenna's property was the north side of a two-family condominium building in an area real estate agents referred to as the Brentwood Flats, or sometimes the poor man's Brentwood. McKenna had had her name on a for sale sign in front of that property for more than 6 months when she received a call from Nicole in October 1993. According to McKenna, "It's not exactly an ace area of Brentwood south of Sunset. The windows were double-paned, so you couldn't hear the noise on the street. And when I marketed the property, I told potential buyers, including Nicole, 'You're not going to be doing any outdoor entertaining with all the buses and sirens screaming by.' But the three-story condominium did have its advantages. It was modern, built in 1991, and it had a two-story living room, several skylights, and an assortment of high-end accoutrements, including a jacuzzi, a Sub-Zero refrigerator, and a kitchen full of marble countertops. But McKenna couldn't sell it until Nicole came along. Nicole liked the Bundy condo, in part because of its location near a school. Nicole wanted to be close to a playground because her children would no longer have a yard. McKenna negotiated a deal for Nicole to buy the house for $625,000, but she wound up paying an additional $30,000. The seller was this television producer who was in financial trouble, so Nicole had to pay all the seller's closing costs too, McKenna explained. She just really wanted that place. In January 1994, when Nicole moved into the Bundy condominium, her relationship with O.J. oscillated between reconciliation and a final breach, and the financial tensions between them escalated. The first point of conflict revolved around a man named Cato Kalin. Although the Simpson affair made the name Cato synonymous with houseguest, his original relationship to Nicole was the more familiar one of tenant to landlord. Kalin had rented her guest house at Gretna Green for $500 a month, a figure he could reduce somewhat by babysitting for her children. During this period, Sydney and Justin grew so fond of Cato that they named their pet Akita after him. When Nicole moved to Bundy, she and Kalin planned to continue the deal, with Cato paying to stay in a small guest suite wedged between the garage and the kitchen. Shortly before the move, however, O.J. told Kalin that although he had no objections to his living in a separate guest house at Gretna Green, he didn't want him living under the same roof as his ex-wife. Simpson's solution was to give Kalin a rent-free guest house at his home on Rockingham. O.J.'s offer thus simultaneously removed a potential rival for Nicole's affections and took money out of his ex-wife's pocket. It also led ultimately to Kalin's prominent place in the history of freeloading. In May 1994, O.J. and Nicole's final attempt at a reconciliation ended, leading to a financial controversy that dwarfed the dispute over Cato Kalin around Memorial Day, less than 6 months after she and her children had settled into the Bundy condominium. Nicole called Jean McKenna and said they would have to move out because O.J. was threatening to report her to the Internal Revenue Service. When Nicole had sold her rental property in San Francisco, she had invested the proceeds in the home on Bundy, but she apparently told the IRS that the new place was also a rental property. As a result, she had avoided tax on the initial sale. For tax purposes, she kept Rockingham as her official residence. Around Memorial Day, O.J. told her that he would no longer permit her to use his address. "He's threatening to tell the IRS that I'm living in Bundy," she told McKenna. As a legal matter, O.J. seems to have had a point, but McKenna scoffed at the idea that Simpson would force his children to move for the second time in a year. "Oh, yes, he is," Nicole told her broker. "Of course he is, the asshole." In the entry in her diary for June 3rd, Nicole quoted the exact words of O.J.'s threat. "You hang up on me last night, you're going to pay for this, bitch. You're holding money from the IRS. You're going to jail, you fucking cunt. You think you can do any fucking thing you want? You've got it coming. I've already talked to my lawyers about this, bitch. They'll get you for tax evasion, bitch. I'll see to it. You're not going to have a dime left, bitch," etc. On Monday, June 6th, O.J. delivered on his threat. He put his warning in icily official terms in a typed formal letter to his ex-wife, which began, "Dear Nicole, on advice of legal counsel and because of the change in our circumstances, I am compelled to put you on written notice that you do not have my permission or authority to use my permanent home address at 360 North Rockingham as your residence or mailing address for any purpose. I cannot take part in any action by you that might intentionally or unintentionally be misleading to the Internal Revenue Service. Nicole showed the letter to her friend Cynthia Cheyenne on June 7th. Not surprisingly, Nicole was horrified by it, especially by the prospect of being forced to move out of Bundy so soon after she and her children had moved in. The same day Cheyenne saw the letter, June 7th, Nicole also telephoned the Sojourn Shelter for Battered Women in Santa Monica to report that she was being stalked by O.J. On Thursday, June 9th, on Nicole's instructions, McKenna officially put 875 South Bundy up for lease, asking $4,800 a month. Drop-dead gorgeous 1991 townhome in the heart of Brentwood was how McKenna described the property in the listing. Nicole told Jean McKenna that if she stayed at Bundy, it would cost her $90,000 in taxes, which was just about all the money she had in the world. She didn't want to sacrifice that stake, so she decided to look for a new place to live with her kids. The following morning, Friday, June 10th, Nicole spoke with her friend Ron Hardy, a bartender and host at several Los Angeles night spots. Nicole explained that she was just about to leave to go look at houses with McKenna. She was happy, Hardy later recalled. She said everything's great. She hadn't felt this good in a while. She felt that she had finally put OJ behind her. Nicole made dinner plans with Hardy for Monday night, then spent the rest of the day with McKenna seeking a place to lease. We were together all day looking at houses, McKenna later recalled. She knew the kids really liked Bundy and wouldn't want to move, so she wanted to do something special for them, to give them something they would want, especially a pool. And by the end of the day, we found a place for her in Malibu, a one-story contemporary with a pool and a view of the ocean, for $5,000 a month. I remember walking up the hill there with her. We were smoking. Nobody smokes in Brentwood, so we used to sneak it together. And she was saying, like she couldn't really believe it, I can really do this. I can lease the house and move. I can really do this. Nicole called McKenna on Saturday night to ask when the for lease sign would go up in front of her condo. She was anxious to have it up, McKenna said, because she wanted to get on with her life, but also because she wanted OJ to see it, to say, screw you to him. As it turned out, McKenna was then in the process of switching real estate agencies, so she couldn't locate an appropriate sign until the following day, Sunday, June 12th. At about 7 that evening, a colleague from McKenna's new office dropped off a sign with her just as she was leaving for a dinner party. McKenna figured she would put it up at Nicole's afterward. She put her hammer in the car. McKenna's dinner party was in Beverly Hills, so as she was driving home, she had to decide which way she was going to turn on Bundy. At the time, McKenna remembered later, I lived north on Bundy and she lived south. I remember looking at the clock in my car when I hit the intersection of Bundy and San Vicente. It was 10:15. It would have taken me 5 minutes to get to her house. I said, screw it, I'll do it tomorrow. On the night of June 12, 1994, Pablo Fenves watched the top of the 10 o'clock news with his wife, Hai, a costume designer, in their third-floor master bedroom. They lived about 60 yards north of Nicole Simpson's condominium. Both Nicole's and Fenves' back doors opened onto the same alley, though they had never met. Nicole had moved into the neighborhood shortly after Fenves. In fact, 875 South Bundy was on the market when Fenves was looking at houses, and he had walked through it during his search. He had found it too narrow, too expensive, and too noisy, which were common opinions about the property. Pablo Fenves was 41 years old in 1994 and starting to reap the benefits of many years' toil in Hollywood. His parents, Holocaust survivors from Hungary, emigrated to Venezuela, and young Pablo went to Illinois for college and to Canada for a brief apprenticeship in journalism. From Montreal, he ventured to Florida in the late 1970s, where he went to work writing human interest stories for the National Enquirer. Even though the job brought him the opportunity to interview such notables as the world's oldest Siamese twins, They were in their 20s and employed in a traveling freak show. Fenves quickly soured on the Enquirer and left after about a year. He has since made his living writing screenplays. Fenves' progress in the business was slow but steady. In 1986, he moved from the East Coast to an apartment in Santa Monica. There he began a long and fairly prosperous interlude in a sort of shadow Hollywood. He sold script after script, and they all languished unproduced. Yet still, he sold more scripts. Finally, as the 1990s began, his luck changed. The turning point came, at least in part, courtesy of the surefire topic of interracial romance. HBO Showcase bought and made The Affair, the story of a black soldier who falls in love with a white woman during World War II. Fenves bought a BMW and a Mercedes and decided to move to Brentwood. Since Pablo Fenves would spend only about $500,000 on a home, he was pretty much limited to south of Sunset. Sometime after 10 o'clock on the night of June 12th, Pablo and High began to hear the sound of a dog barking. The actual time, Pablo later testified, was right around 10:15. A few moments later, Pablo walked downstairs to his study to fiddle with a script called The Last Bachelor, a romantic comedy about an amorous baseball player. Shortly before 11 o'clock, he walked back up to the bedroom where his wife had been watching Dynasty: The Reunion. The credits on the show were rolling, and the barking had still not stopped. Fenves remembered the sound because it was not the ordinary chatter of a neighborhood dog. The sound of the dog, Fenves later testified, was like a plaintive wail, sounded like a, you know, very unhappy animal. 7 months before the murders, Fenves had written a script called Frame Up, a police drama that became a television movie on the USA Network. In the first scene of the screenplay, Fenves wrote, "We hear the plaintive wail of a police siren." In the best Hollywood tradition, Fenves plagiarized, if only for himself, a line that had brought him a brief moment of renown. Pablo Fenves was not Nicole's only neighbor who heard her grief-stricken Akita in the moments after 10:15. The dog witnesses, as they came to be known, reflected the peculiar nature of the neighborhood. Almost none of the residents, for example, had what most Americans would describe as a job, that is, a place of employment where one had to appear 5 days a week, 8 hours a day. Rather, Nicole's neighbors made their living as freelancers, mostly in the entertainment business, screenwriters, designers, and the like. And all were prowling for the big score that would catapult them north of Sunset. Many owned dogs, and in the atomized, car-oriented culture of Los Angeles, they tended to know only those neighbors who likewise walked their dogs. Finally, virtually every person in and around 875 South Bundy on the night of June 12th answered one question the same way. What were they doing at shortly after 10 o'clock p.m.? Watching television. Stephen Schwab watched reruns of the Dick Van Dyke Show 7 nights a week. Like Fenves, Schwab was a screenwriter. He had enjoyed less success in the business than Fenves, however, and so lived more modestly, in an apartment on Montana Avenue, about 3 blocks from Nicole. The burly and bearded Schwab spoke in an almost eerie monotone, which seemed to match the extreme regularity of his habits. As he later testified, "During the week I would walk my dog between 11 and 11:30, so that when I got home I was able to watch the Dick Van Dyke Show on TV. On the weekends, I walk the dog between 10:30 and 11, because the Dick Van Dyke Show ends at 10:30 on the weekend." As June 12, 1994, was a Sunday, he set out with his dog, Sherry, shortly after his favorite program ended, at 10:30 p.m. Schwab walked his regular route around the neighborhood, a circuit he followed as religiously as he did his television schedule. "The route," he said, "is one that I designed to take about a half hour to get me home so I can watch whatever shows I want." At about 10:55 p.m., when he passed the alley behind Nicole's home, Schwab saw something unusual. A beautiful white Akita that was barking at a house. It paused to look at Schwab and then barked at the house again. Curious about the behavior and a little worried about this seemingly abandoned animal, Schwab approached the dog, let it sniff him, and examined its collar. He noticed that the collar was expensive. It wasn't something that I could afford to get for my own dog. But it did not give a name or address. As he studied the dog more carefully, Schwab noticed something else. There was blood on all four of the animal's paws. Schwab couldn't figure out where the dog belonged, so he just headed home. The Akita followed him. In August 1994, the Akita would be interviewed by Sergeant Don Yarnall, the chief trainer of the Los Angeles Police Department's canine patrol. Yarnall's report described the dog as having a very nice disposition, but inadequate instincts or courage to protect his territory, owner, or himself. With the dog right behind him, Schwab made it home shortly after 11 o'clock, just after the Mary Tyler Moore show had begun. 8 months later, Schwab remembered that it was an episode that I had seen previously involving Mary dating someone from a rival station. Schwab told his wife, Linda, that a large dog had followed him home. "You're kidding," she said. But then he pointed to the Akita, which was waiting patiently on the landing outside their second-floor apartment. While Stephen and Linda pondered what to do, they gave the dog some water. As they were talking, at about 11:40 p.m., the Schwab's neighbor, Sukru Bostepi, walked into the apartment complex. A freelance laser printer repairman who still speaks with the accent of his native Turkey. Bostepe and his Danish-born wife, Bettina Rasmussen, had hosted a garage sale with the Schwabs earlier that day. After the two couples chatted for a few minutes, Bostepe agreed that he and his wife would keep the dog for the night. But when they took it inside, Bostepe later testified, "The dog was acting so nervous, running around, scratching the door, and we didn't feel comfortable sleeping with such a big dog in the apartment, and we decided to take the dog for a walk, so we took it." They let the Akita lead them, and the dog pulled them back toward Bundy Drive. "It was getting more nervous, and it was pulling me harder." Just after midnight, the dog stopped in front of a gate on Bundy that was labeled 875. Bostepe remembered that the area was so dark that he never would have looked down the pathway behind the gate if the dog had not called his attention to it. What did he see there? "I saw a lady lying down, full of blood."
Context of white supremacy. So that will wrap us for the first audio segment. We will pick up on Chapter 2, Parker Center. The number to dial is 720-716-7300, the code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Number again, 720-716-7300. The code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Email untiljustice@gmail.com. So before I get to the callers, I figured like the wackiness of the O.J. Simpson case and everything that has unfolded around this case and all of the just the enormous list of participants, we could have lots of tangents. So this is not a free-for-all. Any thoughts I would like to share on what has transpired over the last quarter century that is tangentially related to the O.J. Simpson trial. That is not what this is. This is still the book club. So we're not even flying way ahead to talk about things that happened in the trial because we haven't even got there. We haven't had an arrest. I haven't got to the Bronco chase. None of that. So this is still the book club. And anybody who's participated, I think folks have heard me say regularly, let's, you know, stay with an analysis of the book and not just bring in a whole lot of tangentially related material. Man, oh man, let's stick to that on this one. So we're talking about the book, where we are in the book. Certainly we can recall things, you know, if we're talking about how this unfolded, if we remember where we were and that type of thing. But let's try and stay on task. Number one, if people, because I know we have a number of Cows listeners who did watch the FX miniseries that this book, that is based on this book, that is a substantial difference. That is always the case, right, with movies, books, they're not going to be the same. The miniseries, as I said, starts with a montage of Rodney King's beating and the subsequent rioting, unrest, whatever you want to call it. This book doesn't start that way at all. This book starts off with, as I said, an illiterate love letter from O.J. Simpson to Nicole Brown Simpson and an immediate declaration that he is guilty. Like, that is not how that series starts at all. So that's one. What do people make of the massive difference between those two? And Tubin was a consultant on that miniseries, FX miniseries. And then I guess since he has started off flatly, OJ is guilty. His defense attorneys knew he was guilty. He's guilty. That's how we're starting off with a book. I guess folks would have to share. So are we going with the assumption that OJ Simpson is guilty? So he was found innocent. Is that how we're rolling with this? I did check before we got rolling, and it does seem that most people, they I guess have polls, white people and even most black people think that O.J. Simpson is guilty of these crimes at this point. I'll just have to see. So people that participate, *61, what do we make of the difference between the way the FX series that is based on this book starts? Rodney King, not illiterate O.J., is guilty. And then, do you actually think O.J. is guilty, yay or nay? And then, what are our thoughts on the opening of Mr. Tubin's book? I guess I'll also add, since they had it in the flap, what we should be keeping in mind, the only reason we're reading this now, Tubin fired, talk about a Zoom bombing. So they have in the flap that Tubin is a father and husband. That morality, white morality of, you know, we're about family and should get out of here. He was probably doing the crazy calls and all that other sexual perversion then too, running out of the OJ trial from the New Yorker to do that. We had some Cows listeners who said, I am sure this is not the first time that he was engaged in this activity. Jeff Tubin. So *61, if folks have commentary to share on the first portion of the reading. Let's see. Folks who dialed in with a hand up, line should be open. Proceed.
Can I be heard?
Caller in New Jersey, yes, sir.
Hey, good evening, Jeff. I was just, you know, you asked a question. I was one that never believed that OJ did it. I'm in a minority. I'm not sure. I came in on kind of like the back end. I didn't catch the opening. But did this book clarify whether Nicole and OJ, like, were they in a relationship? Did it clarify that during the time of the murder? Like, was there any sex between the two? Was this relationship over? You know, that's one question. I'm just kind of like, you know, so would that clarify? Were they in any kind of sexual relationship weeks prior, either Friday instead of the killing. Same old story. Did the book clarify that?
Yes, it did. If you go back, either in the archive or what have you, that's basically what it talked about up to the lead up to finding her body, back in June 19, or the bodies back in June 1994. It went into the detail about how they were, separating permanently, and he was maybe going to take the heist house, that she was in, all of that, and make them and their children move again. Now the sex part, never really tell. I mean, how they could be going all this and still, you know, maybe having sex, maybe not. But at least the book talked about, yes, they were separating, permanent separation at this point. That's what it looks like.
Okay, because it just, I'm from what I caught, what I just heard, I mean, it just, I mean, even the language. You know, with him wanting to go to IRS, you know, just it just seems like a domestic spat. It just really doesn't, even from the tidbit that I've just heard, it just doesn't seem like enough for OJ to want Nicole dead. You know, it just doesn't, you know. So I'm really looking forward to listening to more. But from what I've heard, it just doesn't. It just seems like, you know, they're separating, and it just never. I gotta listen to more. But from what I've heard, I just don't get the feel or that it would have led to murder.
Hmm.
I could be incorrect.
One of those childish, immature black people who just, you know, do what they call caping for black males. That's what it sounds like. Black Negro male apologist, our caller in New Jersey. Let's see. Other folks who we've not heard from, if you have commentary to share, proceed.
Jennifer Hurd.
Mammy Hurd.
Heard both of you. We'll get our female caller first, Red in Ohio.
Hello, I'll be quick. Hello, everyone. Thank you for taking my call. I was very young when this all transpired, so it's kind of like I'll be learning about it. I know for whatever reason, like, I can picture both Nicole and OJ's face and, like, some of the pictures that they would always show. But I actually don't think that he did it, but it was because of something. I was watching a show about, like, an investigation, a murder investigation show that I thought was completely unrelated, and somehow this kind of got folded into the show. But just from the first segment, it seems like this is another, it goes along with the pattern of white authors really taking, like, painstaking detail to display, I guess, like the illiteracy of black people. I did have a question about that. Was that letter, like, supposed to be an actual letter that he wrote? Did I have no clue if he actually possibly, like, illiterate, or does anyone know?
I had never heard any sort of commentary on, is O.J. Simpson illiterate? Can he read? Does he have spelling problems? Like, I had never heard any commentary on that. So, that is like page one. When you open this book, okay, it's like the copyright information, the title of the text, and all that good stuff, and then love letter from O.J. Simpson. Now, it's not an exact photocopy, so who knows? But, I mean, that would be a lot to make up, like, a poorly written love where you have future spelled two different ways in the same. Like, that would be a lot to fabricate. So, you know, we'll assume that such a letter does exist. Not that I would be stunned if you got, I mean, that's standard, right? Black male football players you could take a standard both ways. That's standard CTE, brain damage, and that's standard where they just pass black male athletes along through the system. Get that ball and make us money, Negra. So, yeah, not that I'd be stunned if you had an illiterate black male, but just I'd never heard that before. But that is page one, illiterate O.J. Simpson love letter, before we even get to the text. That, in fact, that love letter is even before the table of contents.
Wow. Seems like that is really, it's really, I don't know, seems like that's really important to this sexual pervert, which I'm not surprised at since he's an older white male. But back to the book, the other thing was just like what you had kind of brought up about the lawyers and how they were mostly white and they kind of like were in the same social class and really knew each other for years, what have you, and they all decided, you know, well, he's guilty and we'll just kind of go from there, which I guess from my understanding from lawyers, I thought that, you know, they're supposed to just be willfully ignorant and just not really kind of focus on that because that could possibly like mess up the defense. But just from, like I said, the really basic knowledge, because I'm very ignorant about most of the OJ situation, I assume that Johnny Cochran was always, like, you know, a part of the team. So, and then, like, later on, I kind of learned about the Rob Kardashian. And then, like, I guess just kind of skipping forward with the ordeal with the house, and even I was just really shocked about like the alimony payments, like over $400,000 that had to be paid like right then and there, like at the end of the settlement or what have you, and then you know, $10,000 a month, and even like just with the upkeep of one house versus another. And it's interesting how another thing was how like white women, they do, you know, help each other out, especially when it comes to like business and kind of having like those, you know, those white insider information, like with the taxes and things like that. So I'll leave it there and I'll wait for the next segment. Thank you.
Much obliged, Red in Ohio. Thank you for your patience, retired firefighter. Are you muted, retired firefighter? Did you mute your line maybe while you were hanging out? Oh, maybe we lost him entirely. Let's see. I thought his line was up. All right, let's try it again.
Yeah, I'm here.
Yes, sir. We can hear you.
Yeah, I was the phone hung up at least twice during the program. I had to call back. Funny thing, the last part of the reading, I can recall one time where a large pit bull terrier followed me for about 2 miles. I was running to making my run to a fire station years ago, and this pit bull just came out of nowhere and just followed me. Female pit bull, very nice dog. He just followed me all the way to the fire station and ended up the guys gave the dog some water and that was it, you know. But anyway, starting from the beginning, I would just set the idea of a Renthal James Simpson, since I'm probably the oldest person that's going to be speaking on it on this program. He was considered with black people, especially black males, as an idol, because of his football prowess primarily. During that time, and then he transferred into the entertainment world He can verbalize pretty good, you know, as far as that concerned. But anyway, one thing, the first observation from hearing the early parts about what's the black attorney's name? I forgot his name. Right quick.
Johnny Cochran?
What was his name? Yeah, Johnny Cochran. It just goes to show, if it goes to show on the in charge attorney, that white people are not dumb to racism and white supremacy. From my understanding, they thought that he was guilty, but yet they like to win. Because winning also pays them good money. So their defense was going to be based on racism. Which is something, you know, in other words, they're readily be able to professionally admit all of the acts of racism centered in and around the state of California and south part of California in itself with the Los Angeles Police Department and other things related to. In other words, white people are not dumb about racism, white supremacy. Another thing that's a consistency with non-white black people who have sex with white people is a lot of cases they normally have these type of relationships with white people who are below them financially as well as from a standpoint of, and in this case with this white woman, ambitious-wise, when it indicated on her ambitions as far as jobs in her past that she had, which was very low, and what her ambitions were in life. I can recall reading about the situation between him and this white woman, that he would drag this minor into the locker room, in and around the locker room, bragging with this white female in front of his teammates with her when he was still with the Buffalo Bills, I believe. I guess he would fly her in or something, you know, in 1977, according to when they met, that sort of thing. And, you know, and like I said, it's not unusual. Michael Jackson is another situation, you know, having sex with a white person that is actually below them financially as well as, in a lot of cases, intellectually. And that's all I have to say in this first part of the reading. Thank you.
Much obliged, retired firefighter. Let's see. Other folks, we have Miss Totally. If you have a hand up. Commentary to share on the first portion of the reading. Line should be open. Proceed.
Can I be heard?
Thomas in New York, yes, sir.
Good evening, Gus. Good evening to all the callers. Another book with a dangerous white dog just following some random white guy. another reason this trial was so big to me was because I had an Akita at this time, and it just never added up, because the Akita is like a huge dog, very hairy, but huge, and they're very aggressive to strangers, and very defensive, and very possessive. They'll kill your other pets, you know, like they're, and I was like, man, this Akita didn't try to attack the person who, you know, did this, just never added up. I think they use it as a slant on a black male, which is why he placed that letter in the book where he did. But it's a huge act of racism, and that's how that should be positioned. OJ can't spell can't or matter, but he graduated high school in the United States of America. You know, he went to one of the world's most recognized top-tier universities. For 2 years, a student unable to spell simple words Somehow we blame the scholar and not the school. You know, it's just how did he get into that school? I think he needs to score a pretty good score on your SATs. How did he pass his freshman year? You know, it's just, how is that OJ's fault? You know, they let me slide without having to spell anything, and I probably wouldn't. You know, but that's not his fault. Lawyers, the West, Los Angeles Jewish lawyers, meaning that they're a bunch of contract lawyers, none of them really criminal lawyers. One lawyer told his firm he couldn't take the case because he thought it would cause a racial divide. I wonder what that meant. Was it a division between blacks and whites, which not that many blacks in Los Angeles, and they're already divided? And, or is it a division between whites and the lawyers who dared to defend O.J. Simpson? You know, was he thinking of, you know, let me distance myself from this because, you know, I don't want no parts of what's going to happen. It's just, I wish that was clearer. The author kept asserting and making comparison to the trial and the L.A. riots. At the time, the white media made the big deal connecting those two events. But just in the days prior to the verdict, the media was too busy trying to say that this wasn't racism, you know, why this the whole case happened. But right 2 days, 3 days before the verdict was read, they come with that. But just the, you know, Rodney King was beaten in March 1991. And the riots happened in April 1992, almost a year. But Nicole Brown was killed in June 1994, just like 2 years later. And O.J.'s trial was in 95, the next year. So I never caught that connection. It was just that they were afraid that if he was found guilty, people were going to riot. So they were trying to, I think, instill that in people. Cato Kaelin, his name rings synonymously with freeloader. Not because he was a freeloader, but because he was unwilling and unable to be used to smear OJ. So they gave him that. I guess that would come later in the trial, so I won't go too far into that. I'm here with my line for now. Thank you, Gus.
Much obliged, Thomas in New York. Lots of white dog references. Other folks dialed in, if you have a hand up and we have missed you totally, line should be open. Proceed.
Not be heard.
Rob in California. Yes, sir.
Greetings to us, callers and listeners. So just very quickly, I'll just address the question and then my perspective. So I think that why the author is presenting the information that OJ was guilty is because that immediately with the OJ Simpson trial, there was quote-unquote race divide. Like, everybody picked a side. Basically, if he was black, you thought he was innocent. If you were white, you thought he was guilty. And this was, in my opinion, I thought it as a child. In my opinion, the facts didn't matter. The most important factor was just color. And then my perspective, like, a black person can't, what's your famous quote, Gus? Like, a pecan doesn't move in this world if white people doesn't approve it. So like, it's very hard for me to really think that a black person, let alone OJ Simpson, quote unquote successful athlete, black male, you know, commercials, very famous. No way in the world, in my mind, that he would be able to get away with killing any person, let alone a white woman. So I think that, in my opinion, I don't think that he did it. And thank you.
Much obliged, Rob in California. Let's see. Other folks we have not heard from. If you have commentary to share, line should be open.
You heard?
Emmy, yes, ma'am.
Namaskar, beautiful people. Really quickly, before I lose service, hopefully I don't. I actually don't know if he did it or didn't do it. I actually don't know a whole lot about the case, so I will probably be learning a lot about this. I was a little confused about something that was stated earlier. Maybe I just didn't catch it, but there was all this buildup for a white lawyer who had taken the case, and then I guess he thought about it and said, this is going to turn into a race thing, and then decided to back out. I just wanted to clarify that because it was all this buildup, and then he just disappeared. And then the author, Cuban, introduced Cochran, and the segue was like, I lost it. I didn't know how that happened. So if you could clarify that for me, I would be really grateful. And then I'm also really confused. Is Cuban deliberately not questioning why any of the people didn't mention that this white dog had blood? Like, they brought the dog into the house with blood and no one talked about that. Then a whole nother white person took the dog into their house and it was acting up, and so they decided to take it for a walk and still it had blood, and nobody is talking about the blood. Like, it was mentioned the dog had blood, and then there's no further mention of it. Maybe it's a detail I'm just holding on to, but I hope in the next chapter someone says, oh, yeah, the dog did have blood, and moving on. Then the language, just because it's, you know, tradition, fair was used quite often in the first, like, two chapters or whatnot. I also think it's slightly misleading, confusing, and dishonest to have an illiterate letter that's not a photocopy. So I don't have the text. I'm only listening, so I don't know what that looks like. But if it's not a photocopy with handwritten, like something handwritten for us to see, I feel like, how are we supposed to even corroborate if that's true or not? If that is exactly, you know, how he spells or whatnot, since that is before even a table of contents. So, okay. And then, forgive me, I'm driving, so it's not like I could write any notes. I think I'll leave it for there. I think I'll leave it there. Thank you all for listening.
Much obliged, Emmy. Let's see. So, to clarify, the fella, Robert Shapiro, calls this meeting the Jewish Mafia of Attorneys. And it is Marshall Grossman is the fella who, he comes to the meeting, hear the pitch, do you want to maybe think about being on the OJ defense team? And he thinks about it, and he sends an email out to his staff. He's the one who says, I think, let me get the exact language, the Simpson case carries with it a high risk of racial divisiveness for our community, a situation which I don't wish to contribute to. He's the one, Mr. Grossman. I would have appreciated more detail around that as well. And then, yeah, they cut from that directly to Johnny Cochran. Let's see. Did we nabbed all the folks, or at least I don't see any hands that we missed. I'll try to get in a few quick comments. Let's see. The Jewish mafia, just do they have a Negro mafia of attorneys or powerful folks who are not criminals anywhere in the world, certainly anywhere in the U.S., since we just finished the book Case Comparing Jewish Treatment in Nazi Germany to Black People. Let's see. He called this a famously inbred group, sexual perversion. We are reading this because of the whole Zoom penis and all that, but he said this is a famously inbred group. Dr. Martin Kevorkian talked about that as white culture in general. You have to have lots of inbreeding if you're going to have a tiny population on the planet, less than 10% individuals classified as white. You're going to have lots of inbreeding to keep that going. Let's see. They say, of course, they knew. Of course, Robert Shapiro and Johnny Cochran knew from the start what any reasonably attentive student of the murders of Nicole Brown Simpson and Ronald Lyle Goldman could see, that O.J. Simpson was guilty of killing them. I don't even think that is the case now, 25 years removed I think the basics. I'm not an attorney. I'm not an expert on the O.J. Simpson case or anything else. All that's it. I think for murder trials, one important thing is often a murder weapon. They don't have that in this case. Another important thing was a witness. You don't have a witness who, yes, I saw Juice, illiterate nigra, stab these white people. You don't have that either. So, I could at least give a pause to this is not exactly, oh yeah, slam dunk, he did it. But I thought that was important for such a deliberate, definitive. This book was published in 1996, so this is 1 year after the verdict, still kind of right in the middle of, you know, all the emotion around this. Let's see. I thought it was important as well. He makes it definitive. He says the prosecutors were undone by the twin afflictions most common among government lawyers: arrogance, mostly Marcia Clark, white woman, and ineptitude, largely Christopher Darden. So the white woman, she was arrogant. The black male, incompetent. So that's, we've already, just in the prologue, OJ is illiterate, Christopher Darden is incompetent. I don't know if how we feel about Johnny Cochran at this point, but at least two of the main black males, kind of on the dumb side. Let's see. At its core, the Simpson case was a horrific yet routine domestic violence homicide. I don't, even that, I will say again, I didn't study this case. I'm with Emmy and some of the other folks who said, hey, I didn't watch this. I didn't sit around and watch the trial every day. I haven't read about this and researched all of this. So I'm kind of learning about all of this in a serious, a studious manner for the first time. All of that said, they said this fella, I think we're going to get a section about some gloves at some point, right? Either he was an upset, illiterate, savage, raping nigra and went wild about this white woman and killed the two, or he planned to do all this and he had the gloves. Which is it? It can't be both. Did he have the gloves and he planned to go and do all of this stuff? Or was he just upset? He saw her and went into rage and killed. I mean, it can't be both. You got to give me one or the other. Let's see. He mentioned Alan Dershowitz. I was a little bit embarrassed again because I said, oh man, so many of the people that I like to talk about and subject matters that we like to talk about are in this here book. Alan Dershowitz. I was just reading about this here fella. Rape, sexual perversion. Again, that's why we're reading this book right now. About Jeffrey Epstein, another white sexual pervert who was raping children. Now, the interesting thing is that Alan Dershowitz said the exact same thing when he was talking about his defense of Jeffrey Epstein raping white children. He said, once I decide to take a case, I have only one agenda. I want to win. I will try by every fair, that word again, and legal means to get my client off without regard to the consequence. They even sometimes use that as sexual double entendre, get my client off. But anyway, that's almost verbatim exactly what Dershowitz said in his PAL. And he was even accused, I forgot how to even mention it, wasn't just Jeffrey Epstein. It was Harvey Weinstein, and Dershowitz himself was accused of raping white children. Oh, my God. Woo. Why are we reading this right now? Anyway, so chapter one is titled Drop Dead Gorgeous. For whatever reason, it made me immediately think of the last book we read in Case, where she kept mentioning blonde white women like Governor Brewer in Arizona, and blonde white women this and blonde white women that. The power of the blonde white woman. Let's see. Next I had. Now, when we had Dr. Jane Daly on the program last week, and a lot of white people in her book, she was talking about the Loving case. She did not include Mildred Loving's age, 11, at the time when she met her white male partner at 17. But she did put his age in, and I called attention to that. Why would you give one's age and not the other? If you give both ages, you would think about this correctly, like, maybe there's something wrong about this. They do it the correct way in this book. Shortly after O.J. bought the house, he began seeing 18-year-old Nicole Brown, and then he separated from his wife, Margaret. At the time, O.J. was 30 and near the end of his professional football career. That's exactly what I've said about all of these. If it was this type of arrangement, you would have a whole lot of folks like, I don't know how I feel about that. That's not jump up and down and whoopee, want to celebrate some ogreish pretend black male being with some, you know, almost a child white woman. Like, ugh, something untoward about that from the very beginning. Let's see. He uses the word hostage. He says, as their divorce litigation went forward in 1992, it became clear that Nicole had many years earlier made herself a hostage. Pause right there. We're in a system of white supremacy. If you want to be a lazy, no-count white person, Cato, Caitlin, not have a job and just freeload off niggers or whomever, cool in the gang. Don't call yourself a hostage. You can get a job. You can do something like, please, a hostage to O.J.? Come on. And you're not just a white woman in Kansas like Obama's mom. You're not a no-count Appalachian white woman. You're in Brentwood, California. You got white homies who can hook you up. You're going to tell me she... Let's see. Interracial sex is always a surefire topic. They were talking about the fiery HBO film Affair, The Affair, which I have not seen. And then we got the topic of the mini dogs as they go out for walking their dogs before the body was found. Great point about the dog having blood on its paws. I would not bring a wayward critter into my residence with bloody paws, and he's acting wild and jumping around and everything. Like, no. No, thank you. I don't know if this is a vodka, if this is a white dog, and he's going to go crazy and try. Like, I'm good. I'm good. He needs to stay outside. Let's see. Anything else I need to... No count white people, just to get this far into the book. And apparently this is widespread. No count white people with no job. We just walk our dog and hang out, and maybe we'll come up with a screenplay. Or even Ronald Goldman, another no count white person, even he, at least he had a job. But I'll act on the side, see if I can sell a book or get in a screenplay. You have a whole town dedicated to no count freeloading white people. Did any other folks, we can take one thought before we get to section two. One thought. Don't think we.
Yes, I didn't give my thoughts on whether or not OJ killed the two people. I don't know. I would say if he killed her first, that he probably would have a little bit more issues with the male. Killing her would have been easy, I would assume. OJ Simpson is over 6 feet tall and over 200 pounds. and still has some athleticism about himself, and into killing of his quote-unquote ex-wife, that would have been, you know, passion would have been moving him also from that standpoint. But just don't know how he would be able to do it by himself if he did do it. Don't know would be my final answer. That's it.
Another Negro male apologist. You know he did it, caping for black males.
A lot they just had between me and the second segment. And it's also just kind of like a bullshit of guilt. It's just kind of like a full, kind of like false indoctrinating kind of like, he did it, you know, he did it. And, you know, just kill it. So I can also see that's the direction of this book and also other people can paint it.
We shall see.
Is it me, Gus, or does the caller sound far off?
Yes, his volume did sound a little bit low, but we don't have time to amplify it right now because we will get to the second audio segment, caller in New Jersey, second time around. When you come back, we'll double check, make sure that your volume is appropriate. But for right now, we will get to our second audio segment. We're picking up on Chapter 2 in Jeffrey Toobin, The Run of His Life, The People vs. O.J. Simpson, Context of White Supremacy.
Chapter 2, Parker Center. Officer Robert Risk of the Los Angeles Police Department was patrolling West Los Angeles in a black and white squad car when his radio summoned him at 12:09 a.m. on June 13th. There had been a report of a crime from 874 South Bundy in Brentwood. 4 minutes later, Risk and his partner arrived at the address, which was the home of an elderly woman, Elsie Tistert. She had called the police because a few moments earlier, a man and a woman, Sukru Bostepi and Bettina Rasmussen, it would turn out, had banged on her door. It wasn't the kind of thing that usually went on in the neighborhood, and Tistert was scared. She called 911 and reported a possible attempted burglary of her home. When Risk rolled up to the scene, he found Bostepi and Rasmussen, who were still tending to Cato the Akita, and the officer quickly straightened out the confusion about why the police were needed. Bostepi took Risk across the street and showed him the pathway to number 875. The officer shined his flashlight on the corpse of Nicole Brown Simpson. Nicole was lying at the base of four stairs that led up to a landing and the front door. The pool of blood around her was bigger than she was. Blood covered much of the imitation tile walkway leading to the stairs, a path that was bordered on both sides by shrubbery. When Risk pointed his flashlight to the right, he saw another body. It was a muscular young man with his shirt pulled up over his head. The man, later identified as Ronald Goldman, was slumped against the metal fence that separated 875 from the property next door. Near Goldman's feet, Risk identified three items: a black hat, a white envelope stained with blood, and a single leather glove. Turning back to Nicole, Risk made out a single fresh heel print in the blood next to her body. Perhaps the most important thing to Risk was what he didn't find. Despite all the blood, there were no bloody shoe prints coming out of the gate onto the sidewalk by Bundy Drive. Careful not to make tracks in the blood, Risk tiptoed through the bushes to the left of the pathway, past Nicole's body, and up to the landing. From the landing, he shined his flashlight on a walkway that stretched the entire northern length of the property. Along this 120-foot-long corridor, Risk saw a single set of bloody shoe prints. It appeared that the killer had gone out the back way, to the alley that Nicole shared with Pablo Fenves and the other neighbors. On closer inspection, Risk noticed something else. fresh drops of blood to the left of those shoe prints. While leaving the scene, the killer might well have been bleeding from the left hand. The front door to 875 South Bundy was open. Risk walked into a scene of domestic calm. Nothing was out of place, no signs of ransacking or theft. Candles flickered in the living room. The officer walked up the stairs. There were lighted candles in the master bedroom and master bath, too, and the tub was full of water. There were two other bedrooms with a young girl asleep in one and a younger boy in the other. Robert Risk knew his place in the chain of command. Once he had identified the dead and closed off access to the scene, his only responsibility was to summon the investigators, who would begin looking for clues. This was a major crime in an unlikely locale. Eventually, there would be 1,811 murder victims in Los Angeles County in 1994, but these two were only the 9th and 10th of the year in the West Los Angeles Division of the LAPD, and the first two of the year in Brentwood. As Risk prepared to summon assistance on his Rover, a portable walkie-talkie, he noticed a letter on the front hall table. The return address indicated that it was from O.J. Simpson. The former football star was also depicted in a poster on the north wall of the home. On closer inspection, Risk found photographs of Simpson among the family pictures scattered on tables. These discoveries prompted a change in Risk's plans. He decided to call for help on the telephone because, as he testified later, "I didn't want to broadcast over my Rover that there was a possible double homicide involving a celebrity." Reporters monitored the police bands, and if he had used his Rover, he said, "the media would beat my back up there." Robert Risk was only a 4-year veteran of the LAPD when he made his grisly discoveries. His name had never even appeared in the Los Angeles Times, but as his actions demonstrated, he had already developed an interest in, and some sophistication about, the ways of the press. In this, he was typical. More than any other police force in the nation, the LAPD was locked in a strange and complex symbiosis of several decades' duration with the media. The modern Los Angeles Police Department was largely the creation of one man, William H. Parker. Born in 1902 and raised in the hard fields of South Dakota, Parker came to resemble in character the austere setting of his youth. He moved west to Los Angeles in 1923 and drove a cab to support himself while he studied at one of the many fledgling law schools that were springing up around the city. He joined the LAPD in 1927, worked a night shift on patrol, and became a member of the bar in 1930. Some years later, he made the acquaintance of another young LAPD officer, Gene Roddenberry, who eventually turned to writing science fiction and created Star Trek. The character of Spock is said to be based on Bill Parker. Parker joined the force at a propitious time for an ambitious and incorruptible young officer. For years, the LAPD, along with the rest of Los Angeles city government, had floated on a sea of graft and payoffs. The situation became so intolerable in the 1930s that the city's business leaders decided changes had to be made. They hired from out of town a series of reform-minded police chiefs, who brought with them the gospel of professionalization of the force. The new leadership improved training, cracked down on corruption, and worked to insulate the police from what was then seen as the sinister influence of elected officials. This last goal became the special mission of Bill Parker. Working in tandem with the police union, Parker drafted changes in Section 202 of the city charter, which put a cast-iron shield of civil service law around all police officers. After voters approved these measures in 1937, it became virtually impossible to fire cops. They could only be dismissed by a panel of their invariably sympathetic brethren. The law even decreed that the police chief would be selected according to civil service guidelines, which meant that the LAPD would determine for itself who would serve as its leader. Once selected, the chief would also enjoy the protection of the civil service law, which amounted to lifetime tenure in the top spot of the LAPD. As Joe Dominic, a historian of the LAPD, has written of the changes in Section 202, a quasi-military organization had declared itself independent of the rest of city government and placed itself outside the control of the police commission, city hall, or any other elected public officials, outside the democratic system of checks and balances. Parker became chief in 1950, when Los Angeles was in the midst of a period of spectacular post-war growth. At that point, the city was no longer, in H.L. Mencken's phrase, a double Dubuque, an insular, nearly all-white outpost of the Midwest on the Pacific Ocean. But if Los Angeles was changing, the LAPD was not. Parker's model for his force was the Marine Corps, and so the police became tantamount to an army of occupation for those in the city who did not share Parker's ethnic heritage. As far as the rest of the world was concerned, though, the LAPD under Bill Parker became known as a model of efficiency and skill. This did not happen by accident. Shortly after Parker took charge, he became acquainted with a young radio producer named Jack Webb. In 1949, Webb had started a radio series, Dragnet, based on the exploits of the LAPD. At first, Parker was suspicious of the show, worried that it might place his beloved department in an unflattering light. Aware of his discomfort, Webb proposed a deal. In return for the LAPD's cooperation, he would give the department the right to approve every script. Parker's suspicions eased. When Dragnet moved to television, Parker understood just how advantageous an arrangement he had struck. Sergeant Joe Friday became the paradigm of what Parker wanted in an LAPD officer, an incorruptible white man who, with scientific detachment, descended on neighborhoods where he had no personal or emotional ties to clean up the messes made by the vaguely distasteful residents of the city. Soon Parker was only too happy to have Dragnet conclude each week with the announcement, "You have just seen Dragnet, a series of authentic cases from official files. Technical advice for Dragnet comes from the offices of Chief of Police W.H. Parker, Los Angeles Police Department." Jack Webb, who later wrote an admiring biography of Parker, had created one of the longest-lived genres in television programming, the L.A. police drama, which has included at various times the Mod Squad, Adam 12, Felony Squad, Blue Thunder, SWAT, Strike Force, Chopper One, The Rookies, Hunter, and T.J. Hooker. As Joe Dominic wrote, for 25 consecutive seasons, at least one LAPD show was being aired on network television. They portrayed the LAPD in a manner that made Bill Parker proud. Parker and his wife never had children, and the chief remained aloof from most of his colleagues on the force. He did, however, take a special shine to the young officer who was assigned to be his personal chauffeur, Darrell Gates. Together, the two men refined a theory of proactive policing, which featured relentless confrontations between heavily armed officers and the hostile populations they patrolled. Parker and Gates came of age in an era when white cops didn't have to rein in their feelings about African Americans. When Watts exploded in 1965, a rebellion set off by a confrontation between a black motorist and a uniformed officer of the California Highway Patrol, Parker compared the black rioters to monkeys in a zoo. A year later, a black man named Leonard Deadweiler was rushing his pregnant wife to the hospital when he was stopped by police for speeding. In the ensuing confrontation, the unarmed Deadweiler was shot dead. Police are not supposed to stand by and watch a car speeding down the street at 80 miles per hour, Parker explained. The officer did something he thought would successfully conclude a police action. All he is guilty of is trying to do his job. True to the intent of the civil service law, Parker served until he died, and Gates took over as chief in 1978. The selection process that led to Gates's appointment seemed designed as a direct affront to the city's black community. To head the internal review of candidates for the job, the LAPD brought in Curtis LeMay, the far right-wing former Air Force general who had served as George Wallace's running mate in 1968, and earlier had promised to bomb North Vietnam back to the Stone Age. After Gates took over, the list of black victims of the LAPD grew ever longer. In 1979, Yulia Love, a 39-year-old black widow who was late in paying her gas bill, hit a meter reader on the arm with a garden shovel. The utility man summoned police officers, who, rather than defuse the situation, shot Love dead at point-blank range. In 1982, after a number of African-American men died from police chokeholds, Gates observed that the deaths might have been caused by the distinctive physiology of the black victims. "We may be finding that in some blacks, when the chokehold is applied, the veins or arteries do not open up as fast as they do on normal people." It mattered little that Los Angeles had had a black mayor, Tom Bradley, since 1973. The LAPD answered to no one. A raid on a suspected narcotics operation in August 1988 may have been the paradigmatic LAPD operation. About 80 police officers and one helicopter swooped in on four apartments and two small buildings at 39th Street and Dalton Avenue, on the periphery of the South Central District. The officers, armed with shotguns and sledgehammers, barreled through the rooms. They tore plumbing out of the walls, ripped a stairway from its moorings, pulled carpet from the floor, destroyed furniture and appliances, and kicked and punched the stunned residents. For all the terror it unleashed, the raid netted only two minor drug arrests. Nevertheless, the officers on the scene did find reasons to take 32 residents of the complex back to the local precinct, where the captives were forced to whistle the theme song from the 1960s situation comedy, The Andy Griffith Show. Before they left the Dalton homes, some officers had spray-painted the words LAPD Rules on the walls. Less than 3 years later, a passerby videotaped LAPD officers beating unarmed motorist Rodney King. On April 30, 1992, the four officers who administered the beating were acquitted in a trial that had been moved from downtown Los Angeles to the rustic and largely white Simi Valley. As it had in 1965, the city once again erupted in a riot of protest, rage, and frustration. A Blue Ribbon Commission, headed by future Secretary of State Warren Christopher, after studying the King beating and its aftermath, delivered a deadpan verdict that was many years in coming. "The problem of excessive force is aggravated by racism and bias within the LAPD," the Christopher Commission concluded. "These attitudes of prejudice and intolerance are translated into unacceptable behavior in the field." At 12:30 a.m. on June 13th, Officer Robert Risk telephoned news of the two homicides to his supervisor, David Rossi, the sergeant in charge of the West Los Angeles station at the time. Rossi promptly made a half-dozen phone calls around the LAPD chain of command, setting in motion the police response to the crimes. In an ordinary case, even a homicide, Rossi would probably have made only two calls, to the detective on duty, who would investigate the scene, and to his own commander. But Rossi's supervisor immediately told him to reach higher in the command structure because of, as Rossi later put it, the possible notoriety of this particular incident. A steady stream of officers began converging on the murder scene at 875 South Bundy. Sergeant Marty Kuhn was the first supervisor to arrive. Risk and his partner put up yellow crime scene tape to block access to this block on Bundy and to the back alley. Additional officers came to make sure no one passed through the tape. A squad car arrived to take the two children to the West L.A. station, and two more officers began walking through the alley, searching garbage pails for possible evidence and knocking on doors in an effort to find witnesses. By the time David Rossi arrived at the scene at 1:30 a.m., the tape was up and the scene quiet. Moments later, Rossi's boss, Captain Constance Dial, arrived as well. Risk took Kuhn and Rossi for a quick tour. Standing on the landing by the front door, Rossi saw what Risk had seen. The two bodies, the trail of blood heading toward the alley, the envelope, the knit hat, and the single leather glove. Before leaving the station for the crime scene, Rossi had reached the chief of the West L.A. Detective Homicide Unit that would be in charge of the investigation, Ron Phillips, at his home. A 28-year veteran of the LAPD, Phillips no longer investigated crimes himself. Rather, it was his responsibility to visit the crime scene, talk with the uniformed officers who had discovered the bodies, and assign the case to one of the four homicide detectives who worked under him. In the early morning hours of June 13th, Phillips' on-call detective for the next case was Mark Furman, who would be assisted by his more junior partner, Brad Roberts. Phillips called Furman and Roberts at their respective homes and told them to meet him at the West L.A. station. Roberts couldn't get to the station as quickly as the other two, so when Phillips and Furman met there at shortly before 2, they took an unmarked police car and proceeded together to the murder scene. They arrived at about 2:10 a.m. As Furman approached the scene, he wore a shirt and tie, but no jacket. According to the crime scene log, Detective Mark Furman was the 17th police officer to arrive at 875 South Bundy Drive. Risk met Phillips and Furman at the front of the house on Bundy and took them on a tour of the scene. They walked together toward the front door and hunched together in the shrubbery to the left of the pathway, while Risk shined his high-powered flashlight on the female victim's body. But because the front pathway was so covered with blood, the three men decided not to try to tiptoe around it and up the stairs, as Risk had done when he first discovered the scene, but instead walked around the block, via Dorothy Street, to the back alley. Rossi was waiting for them in the alley, and he pointed out some blood on the rear gate to Phillips. Risk, Phillips, and Furman then entered the house through the garage, passing a black Jeep Cherokee and a white Ferrari, and then walked up a short flight of stairs. On the banister next to the stairs, there was a partially eaten cup of Ben & Jerry's ice cream, chocolate chip cookie dough in flavor. Risk led the two detectives through the house, including the second floor, and then back to the landing. There, Phillips and Furman could see the two bodies in front, and the bloody shoe prints on the walkway leading to the back alley. Risk shined his flashlight around the scene once more, pointing out for the detectives the envelope, as well as the hat and the glove, which were partially obscured by the foliage. They went back into the house and left through a door that opened onto the walkway that ran along the northern edge of the property. Risk showed them at close range the bloody shoe prints with the blood drops to the left. The three men then went out the back gate, which was, Risk pointed out, also stained with blood, especially on the handle. After they completed their tour, Phillips and Furman split up. Phillips stayed outside to use his cellular phone. Furman wanted to make some notes of what he had seen. He wasn't writing a formal report at this stage, just his preliminary observations to refer to as his investigation proceeded. Furman re-entered the house through the garage and sat down on a couch in the living room to scribble down some of what he had seen and been told. Numbering his entries, Furman noted that Risk had discovered the bodies and made the initial report. The causes of death were still unknown, and Furman hadn't gotten close enough to the bodies to make any definitive finding. The third item in his notes said the victims had possible GSW, gunshot wounds. Furman made reference to the two children who had been taken to the police station, the lit candles, the melting ice cream. Furman noted the blood drops to the left of the shoe prints on the walkway. Suspect ran through this area, he wrote. Suspect possibly bitten by dog. He made several mentions of blood on the rear gate, including a note that said, referring to the handle that opened the gate from inside the property, possible blood smudge and visible fingerprint. In all, Furman listed 17 items for follow-up. He was writing his last entry, ski mask, one glove by feet of male victim, when he was interrupted. Brad Roberts had arrived and was asking for an update. Furman quickly walked his partner to the landing and showed him the bodies, the hat, and the glove, and then they went back along the walkway that was marked with the bloody shoe prints. Afterward, Roberts headed around the block toward the Bundy entrance, and Furman returned to the couch to work on his notes. He was interrupted again. This time it was his boss, Ron Phillips. Phillips told Furman that the West L.A. team was off the case. It was being turned over to Robbery Homicide Division, the headquarters unit that handles especially complex or high-profile cases. Moments later, Furman followed Phillips out of the house through the garage. It was about 2:40 a.m., and Mark Furman's tenure as lead detective on this double homicide was over. It had lasted about 30 minutes. Shortly after arriving at Bundy, Phillips had received a cellular phone call from one of the highest-ranking officers in the entire LAPD. Keith Bushy was the commander of operations for the western quarter of Los Angeles, a region that included not only West L.A., but the Hollywood, Pacific, and Wilshire divisions as well. Bushy had an order for Phillips. Since one of the victims was the ex-wife of O.J. Simpson, and because children presumed to be his had been removed from the house, he wanted Simpson personally informed of the murder. Bushy said he wanted to avoid a Belushi situation. When the actor and comedian John Belushi had died at the Chateau Marmont Hotel in 1982, the news media had learned of it almost instantaneously and broadcast the information before the LAPD had the chance to notify any family members in person. It had been painful for Belushi's family and embarrassing for the LAPD. Phillips hadn't had a chance to act on this order in his first half hour on the scene because he had, for the most part, been inspecting the evidence with Furman. Then, at about 2:30 a.m., Lieutenant Frank Spangler, in charge of all detectives in West Los Angeles, and thus Phillips's boss, arrived bearing the news that Phillips and his team were to withdraw from the case in deference to the Robbery Homicide Division. In light of this change, Phillips decided that he would hold off on notifying Simpson as well. Furman pointed out some of the evidence, including the single glove and the envelope, for a police photographer who had arrived on the scene. But for the most part, Furman and Phillips stood around and waited for the detectives who were going to replace them. They stood together on Bundy, chatting for almost an hour and a half, although at one point Furman and Spangler did approach the male victim from the adjacent property to the north and together stared at the body through a fence. At 4:05 a.m., Philip Van Adder, a robbery homicide detective, arrived. Phillips mentioned to Van Adder that Bushy had ordered him to tell O.J. Simpson in person about the deaths. What should he do? Van Adder brushed off the issue, saying he would worry about it after he had seen the crime scene. At that point, Phillips walked Van Adder through the crime scene as he had been introduced to it by Officer Risk. At 4:30, Van Adder's partner, Tom Lang, arrived, and Phillips gave him the tour too. The LAPD had about 1,400 detectives, and neither Philip nor Furman had ever previously met Van Adder or Lang. When the two senior detectives had completed their walkthroughs, Phillips again raised the issue of Bushy's order for an in-person notification of Simpson. He was concerned about not having followed a very specific order from a high-ranking official. When was O.J. going to be notified? Van Adder said that since it was Simpson's ex-wife who had been murdered, he and Lang would need to interview him anyway. As Lang testified later, "I think it is very important to establish a rapport. especially with persons who are close to the victim, to get information. And besides, Simpson might be able to help them identify the male victim, whose name the police did not yet know. There was also the matter of the children. Simpson, who was bound to be upset at the news of the murder, might well need some assistance in collecting the boy and girl from the police station. So Van Adder decided that all four detectives would make the trip to Simpson's home. Van Adder and Lang would introduce themselves to Simpson, assist in the notification, and then return promptly to begin their investigation of the crime scene, while the two junior detectives would help Simpson retrieve his children. Before they left, they had to settle one obvious question. Where did Simpson live? Furman said he knew. He told Phillips that when he was a uniformed patrol officer in West L.A., he had gone on a radio call to the Simpson home. I went up there a long time ago on a family dispute, Furman said. I think I can find it. He didn't remember the exact address, but Risk, who had run the plates on the Jeep parked in Nicole's garage, told Furman that the plates had come back to 360 North Rockingham. In his report of the evening's activities, Lang summarized Furman's information this way. Mr. Simpson and victim had been embroiled in previous domestic violence situations, one of these resulting in the arrest of Mr. Simpson. Phillips later testified he did not remember any such discussion that evening, although it is possible he simply did not hear what Furman said to Lang. So at just about 5 o'clock a.m., Phillips and Furman led Van Adder and Lang in a two-car caravan from Bundy to Rockingham. The two-mile trip took about 5 minutes. As the two cars made a right turn off Sunset Boulevard onto Rockingham Avenue, the terrain changed and the houses grew larger, grander. Traveling uphill along the silent street, the detectives strained to see the house numbers painted on the curbs. Earlier in his career, Van Adder had spent 4 years as a detective in West L.A., yet he had never driven on or even heard of Rockingham. It was not the kind of street that generated much police activity. Still, on that night, he noticed one of the customs of the neighborhood. Rockingham was not a major artery, but it did serve as the conduit to Sunset for many smaller streets, and residents tended to avoid parking on it so that traffic could move freely. On this night, Rockingham was empty, except for a single vehicle. Just before the detectives reached the intersection of Rockingham Avenue and Ashford Street, Van Adder noticed a white Ford Bronco by the curb. On closer inspection, it appeared that the vehicle was slightly askew, as if it had been hurriedly parked. As it turned out, this car was stopped directly in front of number 360, which occupied the corner lot. The detectives turned right onto Ashford and parked their two cars near an iron gate set in the brick wall that surrounded O.J. Simpson's property. A couple of lights were on in the house, and there were two cars in the driveway. Van Adder rang the buzzer by the gate. No answer. He rang some more, and then Phillips and Lang rang for a while. Still, no response. A medallion posted near the house announced that it was protected by Westech, a prominent security firm in Los Angeles. By coincidence, a marked Westech car happened to drive by, and the detectives flagged it down. They persuaded the security guard to give them Simpson's home telephone number. The guard also said that according to Westech records, a full-time housekeeper was usually on the premises. At 5:36 a.m., Phillips began calling Simpson's number on his cellular phone. But Simpson's answering machine, "This is O.J.," the message began, took the call each time. Furman hung back while the other three detectives tried to raise someone in the house. Though he had been a police officer for 19 years, he was a level 2 detective, while the others were at level 3. In the hierarchical world of the LAPD, it was therefore his place to defer. So, with nothing to do, Furman wandered around the corner, back to Rockingham, and over to the Bronco. He shined his small pocket flashlight into the back and saw papers addressed to O.J. Simpson. Furman then studied the driver's door and noticed a small red stain just above the handle. Near the bottom of the door, on the exposed portion of the door sill, he saw several more thin red stripes. "I think I saw something on the Bronco," Furman called to Van Adder. The senior detective came by to study the vehicle more closely, and the two men agreed that the stains looked like blood. Van Adder directed Furman to run the license plates and see who owned the car. The plates came back to the Hertz Corporation, whose products Simpson had long endorsed. Van Adder and Lang conferred. They decided that Van Adder would radio a request for a police criminalist to come and test the stain and see if it really was blood on the Bronco door. More generally, as they testified later, Van Adder and Lang were growing concerned about what might have happened inside Simpson's property. They had just come from the scene of a brutal murder. Someone was supposed to be living at the Simpson home, at least a housekeeper, and there was no answer, even though lights were on. There appeared to be blood on the car outside. As Lang said later in court, "I felt that someone inside that house may be the victim of a crime. Maybe bleeding, or worse," Van Adder testified. "After leaving a very violent, bloody murder scene, I believed something was wrong there. I made a determination that we needed to go over, to go into the property." Furman, by far the youngest and fittest of the four detectives on the scene, volunteered. "I can go over the wall," he said. "Okay, go," said Lang. Furman hoisted himself over the 6-foot-high brick wall, then stepped to his right and manually opened the hydraulic gate. The four detectives entered O.J. Simpson's property. Simpson's dog, a black chow, did not stir as the detectives passed it on their way to the front door. Van Adder knocked. No answer. They waited 2 or 3 minutes, knocked again, and still heard no stirring inside. The four detectives decided to take a look around, and so, still using flashlights in the moments before dawn, they walked together toward the rear of the house. There they saw a row of 3 guest houses, though they were really more like connected rooms, each with its own entrance. Phillips peered into one. "I see someone inside," he said. Phillips knocked, and almost immediately a disheveled man who obviously had just awoken answered the door. Shaking his mane of blonde hair out of his eyes, Cato Kalin stared at Phillips, who identified himself and asked, "Is O.J. Simpson home?" The groggy Kalin said he didn't know, but suggested the officers knock at the adjacent guest house where Simpson's daughter, Arnell, lived. Phillips, accompanied by Van Adder and Lang, then knocked on Arnell's door. Furman stayed behind and asked Kalin if he could come in. Furman noticed that Kalin seemed disoriented, even for someone who had just awakened. Furman gave Kalin a standard police test for intoxication. Holding a pen about 15 inches in front of Kalin's face, he watched to see if Kalin could follow it with his eyes. Kalin passed. He just looked zonked. Furman asked to look around the small suite. As Furman poked around, among other things, checking the shoes in the closet for blood, the detective asked if anything unusual had happened the previous night. As a matter of fact, something unusual had happened. At about 10:45 p.m., while he was talking on the telephone, Kalin said, there were some loud thumps on his bedroom wall, near the air conditioner. The jolts were so dramatic that a picture on the wall was jostled. He had thought there was going to be an earthquake. The two men chatted a while longer, then Furman walked with Kalin into the main house, where the other 3 detectives were speaking with Arnell Simpson. Furman then decided to follow up on what Kalin had told him. He left Kalin in the house with the other detectives, walked back outside, and tried to orient himself to see what faced the south wall of Kalin's bedroom, the wall where Kalin had heard the loud noises. Furman saw that the south wall faced the edge of Simpson's property, which was marked by a cyclone fence, and that there was a narrow passageway between the back of the guest houses and the fence. I took out my flashlight and I started walking down the path, trying to figure out the residence architecture, to figure out where Kalin's wall might have been, Furman testified later. I saw a long, dark path covered with leaves. When Furman had walked about 20 feet along the path, he saw a dark object on the ground. It wasn't until he was practically upon it that he realized what it was. At some point, Furman remembered, I could tell that it was a glove. It looked out of place. There were no leaves or twigs on it, and the glove looked moist or sticky, with some parts adhering to one another. Furman stepped around the glove and kept walking along the path, but he started hitting cobwebs, which he had not previously encountered. He followed the path all the way to the end, which was an untended patch of dirt, then headed back out, passing the glove once more. He didn't touch it, but he noticed something about it. It looked similar to the glove on the Bundy scene. While Furman had stopped in Kalin's room to talk to him, the other three detectives had knocked on Arnell Simpson's door, which she promptly answered. Phillips told her there was an emergency, and he needed to speak to her father. Did she know how to reach him? Arnell gestured to the main house and asked, "Isn't he there?" The officers told Arnell that her father was apparently not there. Leaving her guest house, Arnell began walking toward the Ashford gate to see if her father's car was there. That was where he usually parked it. The detective informed her that the Bronco was in fact parked on Rockingham. Using her key, Arnell let them into the main house. On the way, they passed the third guest house. It belonged to the housekeeper, Gigi Guarine, and noticed that it was empty, the bed still made. Once they were inside the main house, Arnell called Kathy Randa, her father's longtime secretary, who always knew OJ's whereabouts. Arnell handed the phone to Phillips, who told Randa there was an emergency that required their speaking with Simpson. Randa said he had taken the red-eye flight to Chicago the previous night and was staying at an airport hotel, the Chicago O'Hare Plaza. Phillips called the hotel at 6:05 a.m. and asked to be put through to O.J. Simpson's room. Though he recognized the voice, the detective still asked, "Is this O.J. Simpson?"
"Yes. Who is this?"
Phillips chose his words carefully when he delivered news of Nicole's death to O.J. "This is Detective Phillips from the Los Angeles Police Department. I have some bad news for you. Your ex-wife, Nicole Simpson, has been killed." Simpson was distraught. "Oh, my God. Nicole is killed? Oh, my God. She is dead?" Phillips tried to calm him. "Mr. Simpson, please try to get a hold of yourself. I have your children at the West Los Angeles Police Station. I need to talk to you about that." "What do you mean you have my children at the police station? Why are my kids at the police station?" "Because we had no place else to take them," Phillips answered. "They are there for safekeeping. I need to know what to do with your children." "Well, I'm going to be leaving out of Chicago on the first available flight," Simpson said. "I will come back to Los Angeles." Phillips then handed the phone to Arnell, who agreed with her father that she would ask his friend Al Cowlings to pick up the children. Phillips never spoke to Simpson again. Later, the detective found it worth noting what Simpson did not say in their brief conversation. Simpson never asked how or when Nicole had been killed. Phillips had not said, and Simpson did not ask, whether she had been killed in an accident or a murder. The drowsy children waited at the police station for someone to explain what had happened to them. At one point, 8-year-old Sydney Simpson asked to make a phone call, and she dialed her home number. The answering machine picked up, and Sydney left a message. "Mommy, please call me back. I want to know what happened last night. Why did we have to go to the police station? Please answer, Mommy. Please answer, Mommy. Please answer, Mommy. Please answer. Bye."
Context of white supremacy. So that is where we will pick up at for next Thursday. We'll pick up on Chapter 3, Jeffrey Toobin. The run of his life, the people versus O.J. Simpson. So for comparison, the FX series by the same title, we would still be in episode one. Just for general comparison's sake, in terms of the amount of detail, the FX series is like 10 series, so it's like 9 hours or so of viewing. For White Dog, the first audio segment, that covered about half of the movie. Now, it differed greatly from then on, but I mean, just the first little bit of reading of the book White Dog, that's about half the movie. So just scale, we would still be in the first. In fact, we wouldn't even be at the end of the first episode of the series in terms of, you know, how they compare. Anywho, the number to dial is 720-716-7300, the code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. If we have folks, if you did not get to share at all, definitely press *61. Get your hand up now. Don't wait till the last minute. If you have any thoughts you would like to share on the text where we are at this point in the O.J. Simpson saga as told by Jeffrey Toobin. All the folks who dialed in with a hand up, Emmy, a victim in New Jersey, retired firefighter. Let's see, Thomas in New York, and Robert in California should all be with us. I'll keep an eye out for other callers as well. Proceed.
Can I be heard?
Yes.
Thomas in New York.
Yes, sir. Yeah, you were right, Gus. No witnesses, no weapon, no motive. A black man killed his baby mama so he could take care of his kids in America. That don't even sound logical by the white man's propaganda against us. But the major reason this was the trial of the century was the motive that they used to prosecute him and that the media perpetuated was the black male savage attraction to this white woman. He just couldn't let this beautiful white woman go. I mean, which, you know, that was the motive they used. Jewish mafia of lawyers, Nicole Brown Simpson, a German Jew, and Var Goldman, an American Jew. I could see the conflict of interest. Very good, because I didn't know a lot of how the LAPD influenced Hollywood. Mr. Spock and Dragnet and Hunter, William Parker. I read up on him while, you know, the book was going on. It says the Parker family migrated to Los Angeles, California in 1922 for better opportunities when the city was advertised as the white spot in America. During the period, despite this advertisement, the Parker family were the clear minority in their distinctly white Anglo-Saxon Protestant Los Angeles due to their Catholic religion. I said, oh, these white ethnic, these lower caste white people, and rises up to become the chief of police and practice racism against black people. If we feel OJ is guilty or innocent, it's not really important. That's what the white supremacists want to reduce this whole case to cover their massive failures. It's now a matter of opinion. Using all forms of media, they have allowed themselves to convict O.J. in the court of public opinion. The truth is, they did not accomplish their goal to convict him and prove that he did it beyond reasonable doubt. Here you have this accomplished, rich, famous black male, this poor white ex-wife who only had $90,000 to her name, who's raising his two children. You know, I mean, doesn't even sound logical. So they reduced this whole, the innocent verdict that OJ received in the court of justice to the verdict of guilty in their court of public opinion. And that's how it's worked over the years. I've seen black people who watched this case with me and swore he didn't do it. And, you know, we followed every part of it. And we could prove he didn't do it using the case. And after a few years of that being just the way it's presented in television, that's how now they perceive it. Oh, he was guilty. It's just not even thinking about it. They said Mark Furman was the 17th officer into the crime scene. Furman at home gets a call to meet at the station so they could go to an active crime scene where it seems like at least 15 cops had already been. Just think of how much blood tracking that is. They contaminated this. Like, I'm just listening to the preponderance of evidence knowing the case, and I'm just listening to how when you have a crime scene, that's not how you handle it. And I'll mute my line. Thank you.
Much obliged, Thomas in New York. Let's see. Other folks who dialed in with a hand up, if you have commentary to share, line should be open.
Can I be heard again?
Retired firefighter. Yes, sir.
Yes, that was a long list of notorious white males. I can remember watching episodes of Dragnet, and just the Jack Webb character was always in the segments, had to have the last word. That's one thing I remember about the series. Curtis LeMay. Curtis LeMay, legendary general in the United States Army Air Corps. That's what it was before it became the U.S. Air Force. He was instrumental. He was so vicious. He was instrumental into changing the method of bombing in Japan, instead of from a very high heights, because of the weather was so unpredictable in Japan, he decided to have them to fly low and drop incendiary bombs on the cities. They weren't interested into no military target. The target was non-white people that were called Japanese. And he murdered more people than those two bombs that was dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. He killed way more people during those bombardment series that he orchestrated. The police chief of the city of Los Angeles. Los Angeles Police Department, to my understanding, was the first police department to have a special weapons and tactics outfit. And it was generally based upon killing the Black Panther Party. Geronimo Pratt did a pretty good job of teaching military tactics to the Panthers at that time, especially in Los Angeles. And there's a quote unquote famous infamous shootout that took place between LAPD and the Black Panther Party in Los Angeles, I believe in 1968, if I'm not mistaken, that you can see on a documentary on it. But anyway, very notorious, and it wouldn't be by accident that the person that would take over the job would be his protege that drove for him. And I can remember the non-white black male mayor of the city of Los Angeles just losing his mind over the idea that he couldn't fire this white person. He couldn't fire this white person at all. He stayed on the job, I believe, until he decided he wanted to leave. I forgot his name, the guy who ended up getting the job from the past director, white male director. But, what else was I about to say about OJ? One thing that made the trial, I didn't really watch it because it wasn't, really interesting to me. At that time, O.J. Simpson still had a lot of popularity. Of course, he wasn't a football player. He had stopped, he had retired, had been retired for about maybe 15, 20 years. But he was prominent on television, all of the time. He did bit parts in movies. So basically, he was a well, and also, of course, he was the major person who participated in advertising different things, especially Hertz. His Hertz commercials were legendary, as far as they're concerned. So that alone, I can see on why that case was so popular. And amongst, like I say, amongst black people at that time, I was on the fire department. I was on the fire department by that time, maybe about 12, 13 years. So he was quite prominent amongst black people now. Handsome guy, you know, that sort of thing. So, I can see why it was so prominent as far as people wanted to watch it. And that's all I have to say. Thank you.
Much obliged, retired firefighter in Florida. Let's see. Other folks, if you have commentary to share, we have about 15 minutes left, so no waiting until the last minute. Other thoughts to share, proceed.
Yeah, can I be heard? Also to add, I just, you know, just hearing this just kind of like gave me flashbacks of the case when I was young. I was in high school at the time, and I really had no interest in the case as a teenager. And, you know, I just remember the verdict, and I was kind of shocked. I didn't know what was going on because I didn't care at the time. And students running out of class, black students cheering, white students and white faculty sad, distraught with a blank stare. I remember it like it was yesterday. I really never understood what was the fascination with this case, you know, when I was younger. I wonder if it was Robert De Niro, Al Pacino, if their wives were murdered, would the police just basically, you know, came to the house and, you know, gave the news that the ex-wife was murdered, but they go to with claims of relaying the information that OJ's wife was killed, and they're trying to keep it out of the ear, keep it away from the media because they don't want it to, get too much attention. And some way, somehow, they end up hopping gates and, you know, finding blood trails and walking over gloves. You know, so again, even before the investigation began, it seems like these white people, detectives, and once the media got a hold of this, already agreed that OJ was guilty. And when I was trying to say my volume was low, I was saying that this book is just confirmation of the bullying, which is basically bully people to the opinion that OJ is guilty. And it's fascinating. Like Thomas said, I remember how happy black people were when he got off. And then years later, everybody black is, you know, not everybody, but most people, black and white, will just, you know, automatically say OJ is guilty. Even people who wasn't even born, who was even children at the time, it's just basically has come to the conclusion that OJ is guilty. You know, I'm real, real interested in seeing the conclusion of this book.
I'm fascinated to read. Be my first time given a serious study. I'm excited to keep on plugging through to see. We haven't even got to the Bronco chase, or, you know, if it doesn't fit, you must haven't even got anywhere near to the good parts. Other folks who we have not heard from, if you have comments. We nabbed everybody, all the other folks with a hand up. Grant, I'll get in some of my notes. Let's see. I thought the segment where they gave the roll call, and this book was published in 96, so I don't even know what the updated list of L.A. Cop television programs and such are, but I think that's important just because we are just inundated with movies and TV programs about police officers. It's tons and tons and tons of them. And I do think that that serves an important role in the system of white supremacy. I think all of us probably grown up all of our lives, really, no matter what age or generation you're in, as he just said, if it's Dragnet or 48 Hours or, you know, whatever it is, they got tons of these cop shows. Sometimes even SWAT, retired firefighter, mentioned that they got one of that and they remade it. They got the old version and then they got the new version. Sam Jackson, I think, is in the new one. So they just constantly crank these out to get you to identify with the race soldiers, the Amber Geigers of the world, the Mark Furmans of the world, if you will. But I thought that section was really important, and even the direct influence where the race soldiers, Mr. Parker, can come in and, you know, give tidbits and be a consultant for how all this is, you know, going to be orchestrated on Dragnet or 48 Hours or whatever the content is. When they mention talking about this history, so-called Watts riots and some of these other cases, the Leonard Detweiler case, where this black male was shot and killed by enforcement officers trying to get his pregnant wife to the hospital, I believe Johnny Cochran worked on that case too. I might be in error, and this might be one we might have to see as this, because we're so early in the book that they haven't really given the full arc of O.J. Simpson's life. I'm sure they'll get to all that about, you know, how popular he was and blah, blah, blah. But that will probably be included when they give the arc of Johnny Cochran, that he worked on that Detweiler case. We'll have to see as all this continues. I thought it was, for so many reasons, our timing, again, when they mentioned, this is, again, just the history of white terrorism with the L.A. Police Department, which we've talked about before, even some of that coming up in White Dog. Remember, and in fact, remember, they kept talking in White Dog, it was get a dog. They had all, they talked about all the people having dogs in this case, and that's where they found the bodies. In White Dog, it was, one, all the whites in L.A. wanted the racist white dog. That was one. Two, it was tons of white people there had dogs because it was thought that we got all this crime, raping Negroes. They knew O.J. was coming, raping Negroes. Ooh, gotta have a dog, need a Doberman, keep the Negroes off of me. Watts riots, ooh, but that was a big part of the book that we read. Anyway, we just had a listener who wrote in, she was talking about workplace racism, and she was giving context for her geographic location. She said, I'm in the South, Gus, I'm in the deep South. In fact, just so you know, I'm so deep South, they still play Andy Griffith. Right? That was what she said. So then fast forward to this week, they say a raid on a suspected narcotics operation in August 1988. So this is not ancient history. Andy Griffith had been off the air for some time. So they go to do this raid, and they say they swooped in on four apartments in two small buildings. And they say the officers, armed with shotguns and sledgehammers, barreled through the rooms. They tore plumbing out of the walls. This is not the first time we've read a book where white people were tore plumbing out of the walls. One I can think of off top, go right back to Isabel Wilkerson, The Warmth of Other Suns. They did this in Chicago. Black people moved into the neighborhood. They tore the toilets out of the walls and all the rest of it. But Tubin continues, they ripped the plumbing out, ripped stairway away from its mooring, pulled carpet from the floor, destroyed furniture and appliances, and kicked and punched the stunned residents. For all the terror it unleashed, the raid netted only two minor drug arrests. Nevertheless, the officers on the scene did find reasons to take 32 residents of the complex back to the local precinct, where the captives were forced to whistle the theme song from the 1960s situation comedy, The Andy Griffith Show, which is also a cop show. How did I forget Cops? Jesus Christ. Jesus Christ. Like, right in the middle. I think they just took that off the air like a couple days ago and saying, you know, maybe after 40 years of us chasing niggas on TV, maybe we ought to take this here off, maybe. No more Cops. But yes, Andy Griffith is just ubiquitous. The race soldiers on television. Continuing. Let's see. The whole point about Mark Furman, and he just happens to be one of 17, I think Thomas in New York talked about that, one of 17 officers on the scene where they find the bodies, and then they go to O.J. Simpson's residence, and oh, it just happens to be that Mark Furman is the one who discovers blood on the vehicle and discovers the bloody glove that's behind this guest house. My thought was, wow, like, it is fortuitous. Like, some of this, you might not get access to, like, going snooping behind the residence and all that without a warrant. If you didn't have pretext of, oh, we're just trying to go and deliver this information, like, the general procedure would be, oh, they're not here, and that's that. You can't go running around on the premises looking for clues and snooping around if you don't have a warrant. All of this under the pretext, oh, we're just trying to notify and let him know that his wife is dead, I guess. Again, now, people who don't think racism, white supremacy is a big deal, and maybe Mark Furman is not a racist, and we haven't got that far in the story. But again, just, wow, that is kind of, if it had just been another police officer who found the glove or found the blood, might be a slightly different outcome in all this. But just, that's the way it happened to go, I guess. Did folks have any other thoughts, observations that they wanted to share? I will, I guess, just say, even though I said I've never studied, this is my first time looking at any of this seriously, I will say, man, they keep saying maybe the perpetrator had a wound on the left hand. So if you're going to keep making a big deal about all these gloves, so is there an indicator on the gloves that maybe this person, the perpetrator, was bitten while they were wearing the gloves? Is there some indication on the gloves that maybe some sort of tear would indicate, oh, this person was wounded on the hand or finger, left hand, while they were doing all this? Would you wear the gloves and they would keep you from having prints and injuring yourself in all this? Or you just take the gloves, no prints, and you still get a hand injury? That type of, you know. Just trying to make sense of it all. Another black male apologist, I guess. Any other folks have final comment before we wrap up for week one of Jeffrey Toobin's?
I got one. One thing I wanted to say is, yeah, the media, the way that they destroyed OJ in the court of public opinion, it seems like, Gus, irony is the two biggest black people that white people would use to promote their products. Bill Cosby and O.J. Simpson, look what happened to from that same era. But the way the media would make the police heroes in the movies and the plays and the way they talk about them in the news, honest and people of high esteem, if you really look at it, now they're trying to change that programming on the way they want people to view the police. Right before our very eyes right now, the media, who has notoriously reduced police racism to just mistakes and mix-ups, and regardless of who the black victim was, they criminalized them. Even if they got shot in the back seven times, they would cover it up. But now, they threw a complete 360. I mean, they're right on top of it. You know, they're calling these people, and it's trickling down to the people who view them, the way they look at the police. And now you have people saying defund the police and all this stuff, all being construed by the media. You know, none of this is organic. They're changing the way they want people to perceive the police, like, you know, and they're doing it right before our eyes. And I think this case is so important because, like, right around the same time, and the two cases have so much in common, you have the Central Park Five thing going on. And it was like one on one side of the country, one on the other. these prominent white women going after these black males, trying to put them in jail. One side succeeded, the other didn't. I mute my mind. Thank you.
Yeah, we'll have much more to process as we get further into it. Man, oh man. O.J. Simpson. Lots more to go. That is our 3 hours for this week. So if you didn't get to share or had additional thoughts, just make a note. We will have many more weeks of study with this case. If you watched the FX series, might be interesting to watch it again as we read the text to kind of see where they diverge and what they changed and all that good stuff. If you haven't seen it, that's what I'm doing. Do what you normally do when you read a book. Watch it. They do a movie based on or a television show, I guess, in this case, that's based on it. Watch it and compare and contrast. We will be here tomorrow for Neutralizing Workplace Racism. Hopefully folks at least got somewhat of a reprieve with the horror day. Maybe we didn't have to wear the horror day and the Rona. Maybe we didn't have to be in the office physically and didn't have to do any Zoom conferences. Could just be unmolested for a few days or maybe a whole week if you got lucky. But we'll be here tomorrow, normal time, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific, and compensatory call-in on Saturday. Much obliged for everyone tuning in. Hope everyone is safe, hunkering down. If you're hanging out with attempted family and all that, hope you're having constructive time, safely able to relax, eat some healthy food, and just enjoy company, unwind from all of the stress and ugliness of the past 11 months, really, the system of white supremacy, but acutely the last 11 months. All that said, sobriety would be best under conditions of white supremacy. We will need our brain computer to vanquish the Mark Furmans, race soldiers of the world. In addition to being sober, let's be buckled now. I would say, hey, let's hunker down. They said we need to, you know, cut out the Thanksgiving traveling and all the rest of it. Stay in the house. You've got lots of armed white people fearful of raping Negroes and all the rest of it. The Rona, lots and lots of reasons to stay in the house for the time being. If you gotta go out, it's something serious, not Black Friday related and other nonsense. Something serious, fine. Be alert. Really be mindful of what's happening around you. If it even looks like some white people or non-white people are getting rowdy, loud, this whole outing is done. We are not risking confrontations this year. We're not having verbal disputes with strangers out in public, especially if it's a white person. You should be thinking, this here fella, this woman could be armed. Even if it's a non-white person, you should be thinking, this person could be armed. Like, and they could have friends, homies with them. They're doing their Black Friday shopping, and they got lots of bullets and ammunition, too. So no public skirmishes. Anything gets rowdy, done deal. We'll try it again another day when it is safe, but no confrontations. All of that said, we're sober. If you got to go out, you're buckled and alert. If you're driving, you are not on the cell phone. Again, we need all of our attention so we can be aware of our surroundings. And two, we're trying to minimize contact with race soldiers. We do not want to be the next Deadwilder. Make sure I pronounce Mr. Leonard Deadwilder. That's it. Don't want that to happen to us if we can help it. Trying to minimize contact with the Amber Geigers, Mark Furmans of the world. Just doing the small things that we can. Being sober. Really hunkering down inside if we can. Not being on the cell phone. Small things. Small things. Little things that we can do. All of that said, Creator, we ask that you help us remain patient with other black people, victims of white supremacy. We ask that you help us remain patient with ourselves. Remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of black self-respect at all times, in all places, each and every time we are in contact with another black person. It has been time. Replace white supremacy with justice immediately. Cal signing out. Thanks all for tuning in.
Nigga, you so brainwashed.
I'm a victim,
your
brother.
Problem. You're a victim.
I'm a victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my condition.
Mm-hmm.
Even my conditioning has been conditioned.